Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, check it, yo, he's underground. Deep down in the gutter, a real MC, don't miss, don't stutter. Big tune, be bumping out from his boombox. He stays true to himself and to hip-hop. He writes poetry, master the skill. His technique still seen 100 bill. Acting on chill, restless inside. The devil appears to appeal to his mind.
You wanna be big? Join my label, kid. You'll be famous, get laid like there ain't no end. You'll have a halo bling and a payo shit. Number so grown, I can't say the whole thing. And there ain't no cash, just switch a few words around. When you rap, and we'll get you that murder sound. Do some commercials versus some burger clowns. In a world tour, you'll circle the earth like
me. Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off.
Lucifer, soul help maker. Lucifer, soul help maker.
Be careful what you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off.
Lucifer, soul help maker. Lucifer, soul help maker.
I heard this shit before, and I ain't paid in weeks, so excuse me, it seems shady to me. What's your angle, mister? I'll agree to some talk, but in the back of my mind, I'm watching you like a hawk.
Come on, man, shady. You'll be paid in a week, and anywhere you go, you'll get played in the street.
Hey,
I ain't playing, I'm playing for keeps, shit. I ain't kidding, I get paid while I sleep.
Okay, man, it ain't fame that I seek. I'm about making music, not coming out weak. It's the truth that I speak for the young and the poor. For nations consumed by the states they applaud.
See, the secret to you is reaching the youth. So when you speak in a booth, teach them the truth about products that you teach them. It's easy, consume, they'll be just like you.
Be careful what you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off.
Lucifer, soul help maker. Lucifer, soul help maker.
Be careful what you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off.
Lucifer, soul help maker. Lucifer, soul help maker.
I'm changing thinking, I could do good for the community. Help the people make a movement in unity. This opportunity for me, a civilian shit. It wouldn't hurt to make my first million. Okay, you got me, sir. Where do I sign? I'm 9 years running by the time I got mine.
Initial here and a dotted line. Signed here and it's official. We partner now and as promised. Here's your sign and bonus. You ever seen a Porsche, but it's time you own it.
Wow, cool, man. We definitely gonna build. And the car that goes with it. Straight up ill, I always wondered just how it would feel. Now I know what it is to get paid for real.
Trust me, you'll be a famous person. It's worth it, I'm saying. Just say these words, repeat after me. Ladies, body, purses, it's your favorite version. Provide a service.
Man, I feel worthless. What have I done? This shit has no meaning or purpose.
Be careful what you wish for.
Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off. What you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off.
Lucifer, soul help maker. Lucifer, soul help maker.
I once was true, I'm respecting myself. I'm a fool to the game, reaching out for help. I'm looking in the mirror, but there's no reflection. The person I once was is gone, no question.
What about all the money or the blink you got before? You couldn't afford to even think you're high now. You got a new Porsche and women and flocks out whining. Look at everything that you got.
Listen up, kid, you can keep the ice. That shit just ain't me, it's just not my life. Looking tough right now, what the fuck you gonna do? Where's the contract written? I'm taking a cruise.
See, you made a deal, better honor it. Or face the consequence, cause you cannot repent. God won't listen to you, God is friendly. Partners to the end, all you got is hell.
Lucifer, soul help maker. Lucifer, soul help maker.
Be careful what you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful.
careful who you piss on and piss off.
Lucifer, so help me God. Lucifer, so help me God.
Be careful what you wish for. Be careful who you ask for help. Be careful who you piss on and piss off.
Welcome to another edition, the last edition for the calendar year of 2010, Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. In a moment, we'll be joined by Peter Fowler, the co-pilot for yet another show. And this is a doozy. We buckle in. This is going to be a long flight as we continue to recap some of the major issues. I mean, there were so many major issues, so I don't want to say the major issues, but some of the major issues that that occurred in 2010, and many of the issues that we're going to discuss were not covered by the corporate media, the U.S. corporate media, and those that were covered by the corporate media from an imperialist perspective, vastly inaccurate and unbalanced perspective. So we're going to break things down, and that song that just played, that was a song called "Careful." No, that was not Eminem. That was my main man Sheepy from Norway, from Kristiansand, Norway. He's from Kristiansand, Norway, and very talented hip hop artist out there. And that was his song called "Careful," and I hope you listen to the words, man. It speaks a lot to some of the decisions that some MCs have made and are faced with here in the U.S. in terms of what direction they are going to take their talents and arts to, and at what cost, because we know that the hip hop world here, the corporate media here, also controls has co-opted the great black cultural art form known as hip-hop culture, and has co-opted it and resold it and repackaged it to the masses throughout the U.S., into this bastardized version of that basically promulgates and popularizes some of the most racist, stereotypical images of black men and black women and brown men and brown women, all the while having, people of color mimic those deleterious images. And so that song I thought was very appropriate, because this is a new show, but we have a hip hop edge to it. And without further ado, we're going to get started. And so I want to introduce Peter Fowler in just a couple moments, but I want everyone to know the call-in number, as usual, is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. If at any moment throughout the show you want to call in, you have some comments, some questions, we just ask that you try to, try to keep them quasi-brief. And what I mean by that, to 2 or 3 minutes. We're not like other shows where we just give somebody, we're going to be talking about some heavy issues and we give people 15 seconds to get on air and try to decompartmentalize some real deep thoughts. But we do ask that you keep your comments to about 2 or 3 minutes, which is way longer than most shows do. And just be respectful of the show and those listening. But come on and speak with passion, speak with fire, and it's open. Like I said, this is not just our radio show. This is your radio show. This is Your World News. This is community radio. This is what radio is supposed to be like, But we see that's not happening throughout the U.S. And we'll talk about the FCC. But this is the kind of community radio that we see in different nooks and crannies throughout the U.S. There's other folks that are doing some unique things with media and getting the word out, and we're just part of that cog that's just trying to place a million tiny cuts, you know, into the system to bleed this MF-er to death, you know, so that we can have a new society. And with that new society brings new hope and new humanity to human beings. So it's the system that we're trying to bleed to death, or the system that we hope to be a part of destroying and making a better future for a lot of other folks. So without further ado, I have Peter Fowler, who's joined us from Parts Unknown. He's like the mass superhero, but we, you know, so we don't know where he is, but he exists somewhere out there, and he's on air now. And Peter, if you could just give us a few thoughts, and then we'll get rolling with the show.
All right, Solomon, good to be with you. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you very fine, very well.
Yeah, man, you know, this is it's an exciting opportunity, given our position on the calendar at the end of 2010, the end of the first decade of the 21st century, and this opportunity at this point in time to look back at the calendar year 2010 that's behind us in its context as the first decade of the 21st century. And I think we need to take a look at what direction we're going in after one decade down, first 3 minutes, 2011. So I'm really looking forward to getting into what has taken place behind us in 2010, the things that led up to what happened in 2010, and an opportunity for us to talk a little bit about where we're going in 2011 and beyond.
Right. Definitely.
Always, it's appropriate, you know, that you frame each show with some hip hop, and especially in the 21st century, as we look at the demographics of the globe, not just the United States, but the use of hip hop as an instructive tool. So, you know, within all of that context, I'm really excited. And I hope we have some extended time tonight. If I understand correctly, we can get into a lot of good things. So let's do it, brother.
Right, and a lot of good things what we mean by that, good things, not necessarily in content in terms of what's going on, but good things that it's important for us, you know. And when we say us, we're not just, you know, limiting to that to myself and Peter, but that's to everyone, whether you're listening now live or you're listening on archive, and you are a liberation-minded individual. You know, we Peter and I say all the time, you know, we're not in the business of building with people at this stage of my life. I'm just not in the business of trying to convince a bunch of, you know, right-wingers or just neoliberals to you know, to change their ways. You know, we're looking to try to build with individuals who have an open door to inquiry, and with that information, you know, have an open mind to trying to build with others to make an open society. You know, understand that not everyone out there has the same information that I have or Peter has or even you have. You know, I may not have that information, but having an open mind to receiving that information, and also, but at the core of it, you know, working with individuals who want to bring about progressive change, not liberal change, but progressive change to the masses. And that's the most important, not for the elites, or, you know, the rich or those folks. We're trying to build with folks that, you know, that can create that critical mass that can bring about change. Because remember, you know, the civil rights era was just a critical mass. It wasn't the majority. It wasn't even 50% of the population that was involved in that movement. It was a critical mass that brought about a lot of different tiny cuts through different protests and sit-ins. You know, some sit-ins were, you know, 10, 15 people. Some protests were in the thousands. You know, we saw the March on Washington. That was, you know, hundreds of thousands, but they weren't all on that scale. And so it takes a critical mass. So people were just working in concert with one another and within the confines of their communities, to really, you know, and being consistent about it. That's the biggest thing, being consistent about it. So it starts with information. We need information to move forward, and you know, we're just hoping to provide that, and that's why we open the lines to you, so that if there's some information, some perspective that you, listener, can bring forth, you know, please call in. If you're listening on the archive and you can't call in, then make sure you send a link to all of your networks, you know, because, like I said, activism starts with information and being engaged. You know, I know very few activists, people who are doing, you know, progressive work that don't have some kind of knowledge base, some information base within the area that they're trying to make some moves on. So I think with what Peter said in terms of laying the ground with hip hop, I want to go to this bar clip because, and we're gonna expound on many different things. We're gonna talk about police brutality. We're gonna talk about military spending. Of course, we're gonna tie in military spending because it's inextricably linked to the healthcare issue. You know, that was a hot topic this 2010. A lot of people are still giddy off of what they think is a great healthcare deal that was struck. But no, that was a compromise as well, and a compromise to benefit the healthcare and pharma industry, such as Cigna and Blue Cross Blue Shield, United. You know, it benefited them, just like this latest Obama compromise. You know, a lot of people are giddy about that, you know, because of it extended much-needed unemployment benefits, unemployment insurance for individuals, which is much needed. And in a sane society, we don't even talk about negotiating who's going to get an extension on unemployment benefits. So they, you know, but we don't live in a sane society. We live in a uber capitalist society that robs humanity for the profit of the rich and the elites. And so the healthcare deal that was struck is far from universal healthcare. It's far from nationalized healthcare that we see in much of Western Europe. We see in Venezuela, we see in Cuba, we see in Canada. It's far, 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 far from that. And we're going to talk about that because military spending has a lot to do with that. So with the FCC ruling, and actually, you know what, Peter, you know, before we get to, you know, our discussion on the FCC ruling, because that's where we're gonna start this week, and kind of morph to other areas. Peter, I wanted to get your thoughts on what I was just talking about. You know, the link between healthcare and the military industrial complex. Knowing that 53% of our tax dollars, without our approval, go towards military expenditure every single year, and we see that this past year, you know, we see about $60 million or $60 billion going towards health, $61 to $70 billion going towards education, and baseline defense, without even including the wars, and definitely not including the nuclear weapons, we see about $770 billion going to defense. That's crazy. Peter, you know, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I have some very personal thoughts on this topic, Solomon, because I'm one of those statistics, those Americans that does not have health care. And the current socio-political climate in this country that is being... the tone that's being set by the neoconservatives is one of open hostility towards people such as myself. And it is especially egregious when we contrast it with the attitude and the disposition towards the military. So there's a clear connection, obviously. You know, the argument that was framed in the language of, you know, guns or butter, you know, goes back decades, if not a century or more. And, you know, it's the political will that this country demonstrates or fails to demonstrate as to whether or not we choose to take care of ourselves, our citizens, as we look at ourselves as a community? Do we look at ourselves as a people, or do we look at ourselves as a nation of individuals? And unfortunately, it's the latter in this country. You know, that's the underlying core value system of this country. One of those core values being individualism. You know, and that whole bootstrapism, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so, if somebody such as myself doesn't have health care, well, then it's my fault, right? And the government certainly doesn't have any responsibility to provide people like me with health care. That's pretty much the attitude and the opinions that are being perpetrated in our society today. And keep in mind that, you know, that opinion, that idea, just like all of the opinions in a capitalist society, are the ideas and the opinions of the ruling class, and they just get disseminated through their mouthpiece, i.e. the media, the corporate media that you've mentioned and that we talk about and we need to talk about, but it plays a role in disseminating that idea, you know, because I think if we talk to people just one-to-one, I think, you know, most people tend to be caring people and would think that it's a good idea that everybody would be able to take care of themselves, to see a doctor, to get medication when they're sick, to get medication if they're... But politically, those sentiments never get translated into policy and into laws. And so the military, however, you know, is where that the money and the resources that could be going into things like education and into health care and into the national infrastructure, you know, that money goes into the military, unfortunately, in this country. And so, you know, and this is something that Martin Luther King talked about how the lack of resources that we had caused the military is taking that, literally taking the money out of the coffers for the social wealth, for our common welfare, our commonwealth. But it also goes beyond Martin Luther King and liberals and progressives and folks like that. You know, Dwight Eisenhower talked about it. Who are certainly not on the side of liberalism or progressivism, have also talked about the disparity in the way we spend our money in this country, and so it's absolutely criminal that this country spends, you know, well over $770 billion a year on the military, when it's spending only $60 billion and $50 billion on things like health and education. Now, this is interesting. I read something just recently, and this is part of my ongoing research into, you know, the public dialogue. A book was published just recently about, and it was really just a collection of speeches, and the editor makes these political statements in front of, before each speech that she republishes, and it's actually Newt Gingrich's daughter, Jackie Gingrich, who edited this book, and she talks about in one of the chapters, and unfortunately I don't have the name of the book in front of me, but she mentions how she takes a clip from the preamble to the Constitution, all right, and she says, it says in the preamble of the Constitution, you know, that all men are created equal and have, you know, unalienable rights, and among those rights, okay, it says among those rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, what Ms. Gingrich does with that language is that she says these are our rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And she states in her book that health care is not a right. So this is the kind of rhetoric that is being used by regressives and the ruling class to confuse the issue, to obfuscate the issue. And somehow or another, we never get around to comparing we're putting, you know, militarism and war into that conversation. Instead, militarism and war, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight too. And I hope, and we'll come back to it too in terms of trends for of 2010 and where we're going in 2011 and beyond, is the role of militarism in our society, and it is gaining an ever larger role in our society, an ever bigger place in the heart of America, if you will, and that is militarism and perpetual war. And one of the things that we're seeing and that we have seen already is that war, permanent war, is in fact a permanent feature of the United States and a permanent feature of American foreign policy. And, you know, I dare anyone to differ with that. Let's just go back to, you know, let's look at the entirety of the 20th century and look at the American military machine. And then look at the 21st century and see the direction that this country has taken. And let's look at what the United States government is doing in faraway places like Iraq, Afghanistan, increasingly in Pakistan, and Yemen, and in near places like Haiti, the ongoing occupation in Haiti. So that's a long answer, Solomon, to say that militarism has a direct relationship to health care or the lack of health care in this country. And it's a devastating indictment on a country that claims to be the leader of the free world, a country that claims to be the greatest nation on earth and the great experiment in democracy and all these other things, that this nation ranks near the bottom of industrialized nations in terms of health care afforded to its citizens. And I can attest to that personally. Again, I have a chronic health condition, and yet and still I'm not able to access health insurance. I don't have the kind of health care that a lot of people enjoy. And so I suffer on a daily basis because of that. And so it's something that you know, we'll come back to during the course of the show tonight, and it's the kind of thing that needs to be in the forefront of the minds of all critical thinkers and all progressive thinkers in this country, the relationship, again, between guns and butter. So having said that, you know, we'll come back to it again tonight throughout the course of the show, because militarism does play such a huge role in what America is. It is an integral thread in the fabric that makes up this society. So we can't talk about anything, and if we can't talk about anything else on the menu when we talk about the United States without talking about the role of militarism. So I'm glad you brought that up. You know, and there's so much more to say about it. But we'll come back to it in other contexts throughout the course of the night.
Definitely. You can't get around it, and no secret that, well, I guess it is a secret to some, but you know, that it's like, for instance, like when you look at the media, for instance, we often use Fox News as the standalone, like, far right, and they are. Fox News is far right. And, you know, white nationalists, white supremacists, I mean, just friggin' awful. It is insanely awful. But you know, there was a study that came out from the University of Maryland a couple weeks ago that showed that Fox News, that people that routinely watch Fox News were completely off base in terms of global and geopolitical issues. Like something, it was something like 72 to 76% of the time. 76%, you know, of the time, you know, those that watch Fox News on a regular basis were completely off base, and that's not a surprise. But, you know, when we look, you know, it's definitely not a surprise. But let's not think that MSNBC and CNN, quite frankly, like standing side by side, juxtaposed to Fox News, yeah, they look like, you know, they look like the Freedom's Journal. I mean, but standing alone, you know, CNN and MSNBC, ABC Nightly News, they are not places where you're going to get critical thought around military expenditure and connecting the dots between how military expenditure within this nation is robbing people of things that are quite frankly, you know, regardless of what Newt Gingrich's, you know, daughter said, they're human rights. You know, healthcare is a human right. Healthcare, without a doubt, is a human right. And these are the kind of things that are being robbed. Quality education is another thing that is being robbed of individuals. I was just talking to somebody the other day about this, is that, you know, the U.S. Soon, I mean, the U.S. is falling, and it's falling by the wayside, you know, to other countries such as China, many countries throughout the U.K., many countries throughout Western Europe. It's falling quickly, and it's just almost amusing because the U.S. is setting themselves up by spending so much money on military, Peter, by spending so much money on military and so little money on quality education within inner cities, within poor rural areas, and not providing those young people there that quite frankly have a lot of talent. But if you have a crappy school system that is underfunded, you're going to, you know what I'm saying, like down the line, you're setting yourself up for a class of individuals that are not going to be prepared to compete on the global scale. And when I say compete, I don't mean competing in a competitive nature, because that's kind of like the U.S. thing, but just to be able to be innovators for their own country, you know, in terms of, you know, scientific innovations, medical innovations, you know, more quality teachers, you know, quality, you know, college professors, you know, people within social work. You know, social work is another underfunded area within this country. And so when you do that, you set yourself up for failure. I mean, you know, if all the foreign-born doctors decided to go back to their countries, decided to go back to India and Nigeria and some countries in Eastern and Western Europe, I mean, the hospital system, the healthcare industry would just plummet. It would crumble. There are so many foreign-born doctors in this country, and this country is setting itself up for that. And they think they can just continue to do this on and on, and they're digging their own grave. The folks that are running this country are digging their own grave, and they're doing it with their buddies, their cronies in Wall Street, and we know that there's a lot of folks that are part of that 2%, you know, and so in essence they're really the minority, but they have so much economic, you know, wealth that it plays such a large political role, because we see that, especially, you know, even before the Citizens United ruling, how private and corporate money makes its way into Capitol Hill and influences bills that are passed, and even influences bills that are not passed. You know, they banked on having a class of individuals that are significantly undereducated, that not every child in America, not even half of the children in America are supposed to have the opportunity to go to college. You know, but they don't need them to go to college. They need them to not go to college. They need them to drop out, and they need them to accept unlivable wages, minimum wages, you know, working at as custodians and this and that. And there's nothing wrong with working as a custodian or as a cashier at some place if you're paid a livable wage. If you're paid a livable wage, you know, that goes a long way towards respecting folks. But people, we got to look at the wording. When they're saying minimum wage, when you have a country that has them, it's they call it a minimum wage. And when that minimum wage, you know, and you're living in a place like Washington, D.C. or New York City, that minimum wage, you know, You cannot work 40 hours a week in that minimum wage and even make ends meet. You have to have a second job and maybe a part-time third job to be able to just get some breathing room. So they work people like dogs. They take away their humanity and work. And some people have been working like this for decades, and working to the bone with little vacation, no health care, minimal health care, and, you know, all for what? To work decades, working two and three jobs just to make ends meet and then to die. Maybe dying before their time because of an illness and then not having the resources. And we know that most people in this country that go bankrupt, it's because of healthcare related bills and so forth. I can't tell you how many people I know who are still paying, you know, monthly payments, or who are just are in arrears in a lot of different bills because they have this absorbent, this huge healthcare bill, you know, from some medical condition that they had years ago, where they had to go in, you know, and it's just wrong, man. And you compare that to other countries, people that are not, you know, wealthy by any means, they can walk in, you know, with, you know, the similar ailment that you were talking about that you have, Peter, and they can walk in and they can get treatment, and they can get treatment not having to wait months to get referral after referral after referral after referral, to go to this place and just jump through all this different bureaucratic red tape. No, they can go in there and they can start to get treated for their ailments or their illnesses, and not having to pay a dime and not having to have these just enormous healthcare bills looming over their head, you know, and having to go bankrupt, having to file bankruptcy. I mean, which then sets them at a point where they can't get home loans, they can't get this, they can't get that, because they have this bankruptcy record file following them for the next several years. It's just, Peter, as you know, it's just awful. And the military expenditure, it's just crazy. That's robbing everyday Americans of this, and so many Americans are not aware of this. The vast majority of Americans have no idea how they are being pimped, as we did that show a few weeks ago, how they are being pimped and how they are being robbed of their humanity because of this military-industrial complex, this military-intelligence industrial complex is just robbing them, and this whole fear complex. And they have to keep the fear up. They have to provide the fear. The fear. You know what I'm saying? Being afraid of those who are not like you. Oh my gosh, we have to, you know, be protected. And we saw the stories of how the FBI now, you know what I'm saying, has been targeting Muslims, you know, Peter, have been targeting Muslims and entrapping them, going to mosques and basically having, you know, FBI agents pose as Muslims, and they go there and then they drop these ideas like, hey, you know, we should start a jihad, you know, we should go blow up that building, or we should do this, you know, and folks in young, you know, frustrated Muslims, like, turn them down. But after a while, you know, we see where, you know, even the slightest indication that they might agree with that, boom, they nab them, and then they're arrested. I mean, that's entrapment. It's not like they're providing agents and they're going in there and they're hearing a bunch of Muslims, gathering together and talking about some conspiracy, this, that, and the other. They're going in there with these ideas to entrap them, and this is going on. But, you know, it plays, you know what I'm saying, and it's this whole fear-mongering. And then the next thing you know, boom, we caught one. We caught one in Oregon. We caught one in Maryland. We caught, you know, such and such in New York. We look at the Liberty 7. You know what I'm saying? We got them, and, you know, and that was a total farce, you know. And so the people on TV, like, oh, yeah, man, we have all these people, and they're all Muslims, and they're trying to do this, that, and the other. Yeah, you know, We got to spend more money. Have you know, on the 800 plus military bases throughout the world. We have to spend more money on intelligence. We have to spend more money on this, than the other. You know, without even thinking, Peter, about just like without even critically thinking about just not even just the situation itself, but where all that money is coming from and where that money is not going to. That money is not going to your schools, and it's not going to this. And it's not to say that any nation can't, it should not be able to defend itself, but this is a totally different beast. This is a nation that spends more money militarily than the rest of the world. This is a nation that has isolated itself, you know, completely from the rest of the globe, and has just continued to point its finger, you know, and say, those are the boogeymen, those are the boogeymen. And if we don't fund our military strong, we don't have just an overbloated military, they might come in and they might get us. You know, if the U.S. government was a human being, I think a psychologist would diagnose them with obsessive compulsive disorder, obsessive about spending money. You know what I'm saying? I wish someone would just, you know, we should do that sometime. We should diagnose the U.S. You know, from a psychologist or a psychiatrist perspective, and we should see that this is a hyper paranoid nation. But it's the government. It is that invisible government that looms out there with the invisible government, the propaganda machine, the media machine, which it forms that invisible government that Bernays talked about, that controls public consent. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no question about it. You know, and something you just said triggered a thought, Amy, when you mentioned the they might get us thinking, and that does predominate. There's no question about it. I mean, that has been some of the dominant rhetoric since September of 2001. You know, we heard to use a Solomonism, the mental midget George Bush Jr. talk repeatedly about they hate us for whatever reasons. They're going to come get us. You know, it's this us versus them mentality. How many times did we hear people like Bush or Giuliani or Cheney say that you're either with us or you're with them, someone else? So there's this ideological basis there, Solomon, and it really gets to the heart of the narrative that is America. And we've talked about narrative on this show before, and we do well to come back to it because it's so important, especially during this time of the year. I mean, narrative is so profound, and the Christmas, so the whole Christmas season, the whole holiday season, really highlights how important and how influential narrative is. And so the overarching narrative that is Americana or Americanism is built on a number of ideological pillars. Militarism is one of them, and you know, and this militarism, this one of the ideological cornerstones of the military and the militarism of the United States is this: they might get us, or the us versus them, and that comes from metaphorically speaking, as part of the cultural DNA, okay, of what is America, of Americanism, the cultural DNA of the Euro-American domination system. It's what the Europeans brought over to this continent and have spread around the globe over the last 500 years. This cultural DNA that divides everything. It divides the world. It divides it divides ourselves. It divides human beings into compartments. Basically divides everything into two compartments, and oversimplified, those compartments are good or bad. And so everything is good or bad. And so in terms of the military, that's the kind of impulse that the United States government, with the help of the media and all the other forms of socialization that we have in this country, that's what gets drilled into our heads. is this cultural concept of dualism. All right, so it's dualistic. There's two opposing sides, you know, and that is uniquely a European phenomenon. And when I say European, obviously that extends to what is now America, this Euro-American, or more broadly speaking, white phenomenon of dualism, where Euro-American society, Euro-American philosophy, and we can trace this. This is traceable back to Socrates and Plato's, and you know the heroes of white philosophy, you know, going back over 2,000 years. We can trace this. And its development in terms of their splitting the world into compartments, into this dualistic mind frame. And so, the militarism that we see in this country is really a logical and even inevitable extension of the marriage of that kind of philosophy, that kind of ideology that divides the world into us and them, which is good and bad, marriage of that kind of ideology with capitalism. All right, where capitalism seeks always to dominate, seeks always to destroy, seeks always to expand and to grow and to get more and more and more. And so it's easy with these kind of ideologies and these kind of structures, and we need to think structurally, we need to think systematically in terms of why the culture thinks this way. And so in terms of the dualism, you know, along, you know, the DNA also includes this myth of redemptive violence, and that is at the root of militarism. This myth that violence resolves our problems, the myth that violence is our first course of action when a conflict arises, rather than the last course of action when a conflict arises. I mean, you look at, you know, what is valued in this society. You know, and it's this whole, you know, this whole G.I. Joe mentality, and the whole us versus them kind of thing. And we can trace this in, I mean, pick a movie, you know, and it's the theme is always the same because it's part of, again, it's part of that cultural DNA, and it's easy to see. It's explicit in cinema and in theater, you know, where it's the good guys versus the bad guys, right? The whole cowboys versus the Indians, all right? And one of those things, one of the things that takes place there is the identification with the participants. Who do we identify with in these stories? All right, whether it's stories that were told around the campfire, or whether it's stories that turn into movies and turn into television shows, or whether it's the story or the narrative that gets told on the White House lawn by the president, or you know, at the Pentagon from the Department of War. You know, it's the us versus them, and who do we identify with? Right. I remember reading about how when George Bush Jr. was a little boy, he was hooked on those old westerns. You know, you remember some of those where it was the cowboys and Indians, right? And it's that stereotypical story of the cowboys versus the Indians. And in those westerns, who was the bad guy, Solomon? It was always the Indians, right? Yeah, of course it was the Indians. Yeah, and so you know, you see enough of these. You see enough of these old B movies, westerns, where it's good guys versus bad guys, and the bad guys are inevitably and always, perpetually, the Indians. The good guys are always the white guys, and they ride a what? What color is their horse? Their horse is white. What color is their hat? Their hat is white. You know, so there's this continuous bombardment and reinforcement of these cultural values that white is right, that the white man is right, that white American values are right, that they're universal. And that's another one of these core values of Americanism is universalism. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But this myth of redemptive violence along with the dualism, you know, there's only good and bad in the American cosmology. There's only good and bad. And think about it. Think about it in these terms. If you doubt what I'm saying, I mean, think about American religion. Think about Christianity. Christianity is built on what? Good versus bad. There's God, and there's what? His nemesis, Satan. Okay, and on the good side, God has his angels, and Satan has his what? His demons. If you're good, you go where? To heaven. If you're bad, you go where? To hell. There's this dichotomy of reality. All of reality is bifurcated into two camps, good or bad. And that's how that gets played out in the real world, in things like foreign policy, is the us versus them. And, you know, for the most of the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, who was the bad guys? It was the communists. You know, communists just filled that void. I mean, the United States government did not have to create a space for the bad guy. That, again, that's part of the cultural DNA. You know, there's right. just that's the way reality is divided in this country. They just had to create. They just had to put a name and a face on the bad guy. And from basically 1920 to basically 1990, the bad guy was communism. All right. And then with the fall of the USSR and the deterioration of the Eastern Bloc and most of what was at least nominally communist, it really wasn't Marxist, but that's another conversation, there was no name and no face for the bad guy. And so, you know, the government is grasping for a bad guy until September of 2001. And then all of a sudden, we're in a new Cold War, aren't we? And it is a Cold War and a hot war at the same time. And who's the bad guy? What has replaced terrorism? You know, let's all say it together. Terrorism, right? You know, so there's this perpetual war, and there is no end in sight because terror can't be defeated. Terror cannot fall like the Berlin Wall. It just can't. And so it's a brilliant move by the neocons and the capitalists to create this perpetual boogeyman. And see, what it does is it fills all of these nooks and all of these crannies in the cultural DNA that are already there, the good guy versus the bad guy. And, of course, we're the good guys, right? The Americans are the good guys. But then when we look domestically, the bifurcation continues, dichotomizing the American even continues, because even within Americans, we're all the good guys, right? When we're facing the terrorists, but over here, when it's just us, there's good guys and there's bad guys, all right. And that's where racism comes in. Racism was a creation of capitalism to drive a wedge between the ruling elite, the capitalists, and the workers, the laborers, and so. You know, there's all these examples of dualism, and it really helps explain, and it helps us understand how we can come up with some of these absurdities that make up Americanism. And militarism is obviously one of the most destructive of those absurdities. And another thing that feeds into that is the rhetorical ethic. Something called the rhetorical ethic, you know, and it's what's unique to the American rhetorical ethic is that the American rhetorical ethic is built on lies. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't want to hear that, and a lot of people are going to get angry when they hear me say that, you know, the American rhetorical ethic is built on lies. But that's what Americanism is built on, is lies. You know, and we can get into that a little bit later. I don't want to move too far away from the topic at hand, but we can see where militarism comes from and why it's such an integral part of the American psyche, because it is a natural outgrowth of our cultural DNA, and that's something that's really, really troubling. It's really troubling. Right. So when we talk about making change, and we're talking about, you know, progressive or radical deconstruction, or, you know, deconstructing the dominant narratives and so on and so forth, and where do we go from here? You know, that's why, you know, just voting for a Democrat just doesn't cut it, you know, because the problem goes deeper, you know, and the system can't be salvaged by just, you know, voting in a few more Democrats or voting in a few more Green candidate politicians without the system changing. So militarism is something that we need to take very, very seriously. And the other thing about militarism, and I'll be brief here, Solomon, because I want to come back to this a little bit later. militarism is part of the civil religion of Americanism. All right, we hear the United States is a Christian nation, right? Well, that's a lot of crap. The United States is an Americanist nation. Americanism is the religion of the United States. Christianity is just part of it. Christianity is kind of the expression of it, or the visible or tangible part of it. But the real core value in this country is this country itself, Americanism. And so I want to come back to that a little bit later. But I just wanted to set the table for it by putting militarism in that context as part of our conversation right now, in the sense that militarism is a major part of the civil religion of Americanism. And why that's important, Solomon, is it's part of why permanent war is possible. You know, it's a prominent part of foreign policy and economic policy because it's part of the civil religion that is Americanism. You know, it can't be looked at as something distinct or outside of the fabric or the cloth of what America is. It's part of the fabric. It's part of the religion. So it's totally appropriate, you know, that we spend time at the top of this show talking about the role and the prominence of militarism in the American psyche. And if we were to do that psychological evaluation that you referred to a moment ago, it would definitely show some pathology because of this obsession, like you said, this obsession with militarism and this compulsion toward war. And so we do well to spend time on that now, because as we look forward to 2011 and the next decade of the 21st century, war and militarism is a centerpiece of what this nation is all about and what it's doing to us as a people. And unfortunately, the rest of the planet is not immune from the militarism that is part of Americanism.
Right, and few people dissect. I mean, that's because, and you know, the point is out is that, you know, that's because most people have been, you know, systematically programmed since they're kids, even within their own households, because their parents were programmed on the same American society, Americanism, which permeates itself within every nook and cranny of all the public educational systems on up, through the media, through movies, television. But few people have the critical thinking capabilities and the point of reference to look and say, well, based on the U.S.'s description of looking for that boogeyman, that going to war with that ideology. I mean, that's basically what they're saying. I mean, you know, when you go to war with communism or you go to war with terrorism, you're going to war with ideologies and not necessarily even a country. But based on the U.S.'s own description of terrorism, that would make the U.S., the greatest purveyor of terrorism in the entire globe. I mean, so what the U.S. has inflicted upon innocent civilians in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan, and so many other places, you know, going back to Panama, the invasion of Panama, you know, during the 80s, the invasion of Grenada during the 80s with, you know, Reagan's gunboat policy there, you know, going back to the 50s, you know, with Guatemala and Bernays, you know, orchestrating, you know, that whole scheme behind, you know, working on behalf of the large corporation United Fruit Company, which is now Chiquita Banana. People, stay away from Chiquita Bananas. It's an awful corporation in terms of its roots, you know, hence the term Banana Republic. But the U.S. has been, you know, the world's purveyor, you know, the world's, you know, poster face, symbol of terrorism. If we just even hold the U.S. to its own description and its own standards,
Right.
It fits that description because it goes in there. People, you have to understand that when the U.S. goes and does a military strike, they know unequivocally, this is not made up, they know unequivocally that they are going to be taking out civilian targets. But that is considered collateral damage. That is considered, that is, you know, when they make, you know, and they have actuaries, you know, they have people that are trained in the actuary of, you know what I'm saying, and the estimates of you know, how many lives are going to be taken, you know, how many civilian lives estimate are going to be taken, you know, doing a strike hit. They know all these numbers. They know all of these numbers and within their entire complexity before they do these strikes. But they make the ultimate decision to do so, saying that it's in the best interest of our overarching goals. And their overarching goals are sold to the American populace as like, oh, this is on behalf of your safety, because they need the American populace to be behind it. But ultimately, it's not. It's on behalf of imperialism. It's on behalf of neocolonization, and it's on behalf of these corporations that are going to benefit, the Halliburtons, the Bechtels, the Lockheed Martins, the Triple Canopies, the Raytheons. I mean, I can go on, the DynCorp, the Blackwater, all these different corporations that are going to benefit. There are far more military contractors in Afghanistan and Iraq than there are actual military personnel. This is not made up, folks. And it's just disgusting. I mean, look at countries now that, like Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, they're still suffering for the bombs they're dropping. There were more bombs dropped on Laos than were combined, you know, dropped during World War II and Nagasaki, Hiroshima, and even Dresden. More combined. To this day, there are bombs that are exploding and taking people out because they did not explode upon impact. And so there are different units of folks within Laos, Laotians themselves, that go throughout and try to use different apparatus to detect these bombs and detonate them so that people don't, whatever. But there are people that continue to lose their lives and limbs in Laos today, because of the impact of that CIA-funded, you know, that CIA-supported and spearheaded actions throughout Indochina, you know, speaking of Cambodia and Laos. And those are, you know, a couple countries that are hardly ever spoken about when we talk about the Vietnam conflict. You know, that, you know, those countries, you know, Laos was a neutral country during that conflict. But because there are so-called, you know, the VC that were said to be hiding out there, and VC sympathizers, I mean, they drop bomb after bomb. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of tons of bombs just being dropped on this, you know, small country in Indochina. And this is all a part of it. It was like, you know, and so you have all this stuff like the military, like, you know, this was what was needed and such and such, and they were trying to bring democracy and fight communism and, you know, such and such. But, you know, I mean, looking at me, when I look at Ho Chi Minh, he was a hero. You know what I'm saying? Especially if I was a nationalist-oriented, you know, Vietnamese. I mean, he was a hero. Folks, listen, do your studies. He freed his people from French oppression, from French imperialism and colonization. Freed his people, you know what I'm saying, from that. That's what Ho Chi Minh did. And, you know what I'm saying, and because he had an ideology, you know what I'm saying, and a political philosophy that was different than ours, the U.S. said, oh, no, we can't see this encroachment of communism over there. Exactly. We've got to go in there and you know, and go take out that boogeyman. But the dude, I mean, if you like the whole story behind, you know, the original so-called colonies here and the Revolutionary War, you can't not like what Ho Chi Minh did for his people, not just in Vietnam, but even starting off with, you know, his claim to fame, you know, with the liberation of his people from the punk-ass Frenchies that were there you know, colonizing that country and bringing oppression to those people. I mean, he galvanized his troops and sent the Frenchies home with their tails between their legs, the little punk asses. But you know, that's another story. So I just wanted to kind of just reiterate what you were saying, Peter. Is just that, you know, this whole terror thing, and people have to really critically think that the whole terror thing, even if the U.S. wants to use that terminology, fine. If you want to use that terminology, I'm not a lawyer, but if we were in a court of law and we had an impartial judge, not a racist judge, not a judge that's in the tank, but if we had an impartial judge and a jury of our peers, and we took the U.S., you know, and we took the U.S. to court, they would lose across the board and say, because based on your definition of terror, and we apply it to yourself, you are the world's preeminent purveyor of that brand of terror the world over, period, bar none, end of case, done. And terror, because this so-called war on terror, people, you and I and Peter and your children and your grandchildren, your nieces and your nephews are being robbed of humanity. They are continuing to be isolated from the rest of the world, to think of the rest of the world in a very limited, linear type of lens. They're not getting the social services that they deserve, universal health care, and for God's sakes, universal tertiary education. Most college students are graduating now with $40,000-$50,000 in the hole that they owe these student loan corporations that have just imposed these usury fees upon them. And 6 months after they graduate, they're paying three and four and five and six and upwards of that, hundreds of dollars a month. And so they're in debt, and they're in debt into their eyeballs, and many of them will be in debt to, for the next 30, 40 years. I mean, I haven't even made a dent in my student loan bills from grad school and undergrad. So it's a crock, man. So anyways, Peter, I just want to play this, and I'm going to play this clip, this bar clip, on FCC. And everything we talked about, folks, is in context. So, because everything that Peter and I are talking about right now is also linked to the media. I mean, most of these complex issues are not black and white. We have to look at them with a critical lens and understand they're not simply black and white. And so when we look at the media, the media plays a major role in creating that public consent. But I want to – this is really important. So I'm going to play this clip from Brother Glenn Ford on Black Agenda Report on the latest FCC ruling.
The Federal Communications Commission's failure to ensure Internet neutrality signals the beginning of a kind of Oklahoma land rush up and down the digital highways. The FCC has fired the starting pistol to allow giant telecommunications corporations to make their mad dash into what was formerly public space and to stake their own private claims and charge rent and tolls and fees from horizon to horizon. We, the public, are to be treated like the Indians of Oklahoma in 1889, dispossessed in favor of business and commercial interests. President Obama is the great father in Washington who spoke with forked tongue when he swore that he would take a back seat to no one in the cause of Internet neutrality. President Obama, of course, controls a majority on the FCC and is ultimately responsible for the commission's decision. He can't claim that the Republicans forced his hand by holding anything hostage. No, Obama stabbed Internet neutrality in the back because that's the job description of a corporate politician, to facilitate the orderly dispensing of public property to private pockets. The FCC decision was described as a compromise between public and corporate interests. Politicians like Barack Obama believe that corporations have an inalienable right to make ever-increasing profits, and that right supersedes any claims by non-corporate citizenry. Therefore, it is perfectly logical that the wireless sector of the Internet, which is growing by leaps and bounds and holds the most promise of fantastic profits, becomes a playground for the corporations, who will be allowed to do pretty much as they see fit. On the non-mobile side of the Internet, the FCC's new rules are full of loopholes, allowing Internet carriers to create fast lanes for higher-paying companies and customers. Think of the Internet as a vast plain on which a great city is to be built. Now, consider that a few huge corporations will be given the privilege to draw up the grid for that city and to decide who gets to live in the high-class neighborhoods and who winds up in the ghetto. The FCC's decision was totally predictable. Just as Obama guaranteed that the banks would rob the U.S. Treasury blind when he brought Bill Clinton's old Wall Street gang into the White House, so Obama signed the death warrant for Internet neutrality when he appointed Julius Genachowski as chairman. Genachowski was the top communications advisor to the Clinton White House and an architect of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. That infamous legislation led directly to the greatest corporate consolidation of radio and television stations in American history. Julius Genachowski is one of the reasons that today's radio and TV landscape is such a wasteland of corporate sameness. Now he's positioned to do the same thing to the Internet, courtesy of Barack Obama, the guy who never made a promise that he wasn't prepared to break. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So, very, very, and I just want to run a couple things by some folks, you know, just real quickly. All right, looking at the whole landscape, and if you're listening right now, you know, Peter and I know, you know, knows like my I'm fed up with individuals that and Peter and I have heard this, you know, from these so-called liberals. I mean, we obviously know the right wingers are going to say that we're anti-American and this, that, and the other. But really, we're more patriotic than any of them are, because we're willing to air this country's dirty laundry in an effort to make it a better and more equitable place, where in fact they want to have revisionist history and obfuscate history and information and geopolitical stuff, and to confuse the masses so that they can continue to profit. They can continue to, be the profiteers of everything from military to healthcare to, you know, education, you name it. If it seems like we're pointing out America's flaws and this, that we are, they are almost limitless, and so we're pointing them out because people need to know them. They need to know them, and they need to know, especially if you haven't traveled abroad recently or ever, and haven't seen that in other countries. When you go to other countries, sometimes you'll often find out that the way things were. When you were raised and your perspective living in America is not always the best way to go about things. It's not always the most humane way. And you'll see things when you travel to other countries that there are certain things that are just done just quite frankly better, okay? And the things that we may say, we have better universities and colleges than most other countries. That's right, because we have – or the U.S. has this, you know, gargantuan amount of money to invest in colleges and universities, But you know what's interesting is we have some of the worst public school systems in the entire world. You know, we're ranked 27th in mathematics, 20-something in science, in terms of geography. It's not very high as well compared to other industrialized nations. And, you know, you look at the who's profiting from these higher educational institutions. They're not for the regular regular hoi polloi's children here. They're not. They're for the elites. And yeah, you'll have mixed in, you know, some kids from some poor inner city communities and some rural areas that go there that got some money from, you know, from Pell Grant. But they're examples. They're examples. All right, that they like to flash. And those are the examples. The vast majority of kids from inner city communities are not supposed to make their way onto major college campuses, period. They're just simply not. All right, and so that's why, you know, we have the thing, you know, like, you know, you don't have unlimited money with Pell Grants and those types of things. And if you're in that ever expanding, you know, or in some cases, I should say, shrinking, like, that middle class, you're definitely not, you know, unless you have some big money, you know, you're not going to college, you know, and that means you're probably going to have to take on some student loans, and you're probably going to have to pay in your eyeballs when you get out. But, you know, these universities that we have here are also riddled and replete with international students. But that's another story. So it's interesting that we have so many people want to pop out. We have so many colleges, university, but then we have such crappy public schools from coast to coast. So in regards to the FCC, we want to point out crappy. I just want to let folks know, okay, when you look at the U.S.'s funding, breaking down per capita, Peter, for in terms of global spending on public media, places like Finland, per capita, all right, per capita spends an average $101.01, Denmark and Finland do, on per capita, all right, on public media, right? Here in the U.S., for instance, public media is doled out by appropriations from Congress, and it's doled out to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And then the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, they're the ones that kind of disseminate that money. So last year, a little over $400 million, $400 million total dollars was doled out by Congress to fund public media, all right? Public media, you know, such as PBS and some radio shows, and even, you know, some money, a little bit of money goes to, like, things like NPR and so forth. So that's $400 million total. I'm going to break this number down real quick. $400 million, okay? So let me break that money down. So that money, of that, you know, $400-plus million, about $409 million, $271 million of that went to television. About $90 million of that went to like radio, public radio. $24 million went to like systems, like public media system support, which is like professional development, research, planning, consultation, those types of things. All right, so that's funding for public media. So when you break that down, when I just said Denmark and Finland spend $101 per capita for public media. Canada, our neighbors to the north, they spend about $24.88 on per capita for public media. What do we spend? Anyone want to take a quick gab of that? Peter, the U.S. the U.S. spends $1.35 on per capita for public media. So when you break it down, we're talking $1.35, basically the cost of a burger and half a thing of fries from McDonald's that's going to kill you in the long run, one of those poisonous burgers with all the hormones pumped into them. But, you know, so basically – you can go to your, you know, McDonald's. You know, basically, what you would pay for something from a dollar menu, and, you know, plus tax at McDonald's, another evil corporation. But that's what the U.S. spends per capita on public media. know what I'm saying? That's Peter, that's crazy. I mean, you look at Ireland. Ireland spends $59 per capita. The UK, $80.36 for public media. Japan, $58.86 for public media. I mean, Germany, $26.76 for public media. And here, we're spending $1.35. And so why? Because the money here, right here, as Glenn just massively broke down, this whole ruling, this is up there. This is really up there. I mean, not completely, but this is not too far from the impact that the Telecom Act of 1996 had on television and radio and so forth. And it was a very negative, deleterious impact that it had. And we saw the decrease of black ownership of radio by 70% within 3 years after the signing of the Telecom Act. But this right here means that folks like many of you listening right now, myself and Peter, this thing goes and stands. We're going to be looking at, there's going to be two different internet highways. You know, there's going to be one for those folks that can pay the big bucks and the corporations that can pay the big bucks for that fast highway. So when they go to certain sites that have a lot of content, they can just boom, boom, just shift right through it. But you and I, despite maybe being on the same broadband, you know, services by all of the increasing monopoly that is of Comcast, you know, and AT&T, Verizon, you know, we're going to be on a slower highway, we're going to be on a lower lane, a slower highway, where they can control peer-to-peer content, those types of things. And this is the thing, and I get your comments on this, Peter. This is the thing, is that Obama banked himself. Man, one of the things that he talked about as a candidate, and we all know, well, maybe we don't all know, but we should know that there's a lot of things good old Barack Obama said he was going to do and he was going to stand for on the campaign trail that he flipped the script on. And there are things that he did even when he was in office, when he was a senator, that led myself and Peter to know back then that this is not the individual we want to vote for, period. This guy is full of shit, just completely. And this dude is as bad as many of those Republicans. You know, this guy was a devout supporter of Israel's bombing of Tyre, Lebanon. This guy, I mean, just, you know, he voted for the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You know, it was basically his illegal, you know, his wiretapping on us, Big Brother. So, but he said, hey, I'm for net neutrality. And net neutrality is, you know, basically in essence a free open internet, right? I'm for net neutrality. I believe in a free open internet for all, not just for the corporations, not just for the rich. I'm for, so we figured that if he got into office, he'd be able to name his commissioner, which, you know, he did with Julius Jankowski. And the president is always able to have three people on that five-person board, including the commissioner. I mean, the chair of that commission. So it's 3-2. So there's two Republicans and three Democrats. You know, before and during the Bush regime, you know, it was headed by Kevin Martin and two other Republicans, and then you had Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, the two Democrats, were actually, you know, pretty progressive on these kind of issues. But they continually got outvoted 3-2 on these major rulings. But so you figured, you know, Obama is going to get in. He's going to, you know, he's going to fight for that. He's going to name somebody to the commission, and boom, and net neutrality is going to be saved. But lo and behold, Peter, lo and behold, just like with health care, the money talks. And as we know, the more Obama got invested into mainstream politics, because in 2005, when he was a state senator, what did he say, Peter? He said in Chicago that I am for universal health care, everybody in and nobody out. And what happened when he became senator, the more he became in mainstream politics, the further he moved away from sticking with and fighting for universal health care. And just like that, with this, The money came in from the lobbyists, the AT&Ts, the Comcast, the Verizons. The money came in, the NBC Universals. We see this merger about to go on between NBC Universal, you know, being bought out by Comcast, which is going to be bad news for all of us. But you see the money, or you don't see this money that goes in. And what happens? We see these pansy ass Democrats go ahead, you know, and they didn't make this move without approval from good old Barack Obama. These decisions are not made by these three Democrats without the approval and the overall approval of the president, which they serve. And now what we see is a total capitulation to the corporations and an ending of net neutrality as we know it right now. So that's where it stands. Peter, your thoughts.
Absolutely. You have a lot of thoughts on that. But just for a moment, before I respond to that, I want to just make one or two remarks about where we were at before we heard from Glenn Ford with regard to the United States and terrorism and war. I want to commend to our listeners two books, and they're booklets, really. They're very small books. You can read them, in an evening, over an hour or so. One by Noam Chomsky, entitled 9/11. 9-11 by Noam Chomsky, and another book called Terrorism and War by Howard Zinn. And those two guys, they break down the state of war and terrorism in the context that you and I have been talking about. And they talk about what the role that the United States plays as, like you mentioned, the greatest purveyor of war and terror on the planet, and what that means. Some of the definitions behind that. So, especially for any listeners who are skeptical and think that you and I are making stuff up and hate America and all that stuff, read Chomsky, read Zinn, Noam Chomsky, 9/11, Howard Zinn, Terrorism and War. They're booklets. You can read them in an evening. They break them down and they tell the truth about the state of affairs since September of 2001. All right, the FCC clip. I love the way Glenn Ford broke that down. I'm not as schooled on communications in the media as you are, Solomon, as I probably should be. So I love the way that Glenn brought it up and the way that you broke it down because it's something that everybody needs to have some level of familiarity with that, particularly given where we're at in the 21st century as a technological society. You know, media and the internet, or as your favorite mental midget would say, the internets. We need to have some familiarity and some knowledge about what's going on and what the government and in general FCC in particular is doing with net neutrality and with the internet in a broader sense. You know, and the way you broke it down in terms of the per capita spending on public media is profound. And if we ask ourselves why, what would be the motivation for the United States only spending $1.35? I can get a cup of coffee most places, and it costs more than $1.35. But for the price of a cup of coffee, that's what the government spends per capita for public media in this country. I mean, what would be the motivation behind that? I mean, obviously, the United States government doesn't want the truth thoughts and ideas that challenge the dominant narrative to be freely bandied about. And that's what we see if you just turn on any of the corporate media, turn on the television and look at what passes for news in this society, turn on the radio and listen to any of the crap that passes for news and analysis and talk radio. I mean, I got two words. Glenn Beck. That's all I need to say. And then add your Rush Limbaughs and your Sean Hannitys and these other jokers. And that is where America is invested. That's where the United States government is invested, is in that kind of media tyranny. And if you look at our context, Solomon, the Blog Talk Radio, you look at where we are in terms of the proportion of progressive versus regressive our blog talk radio shows, and we're by far in the minority. You know, the regressives even have a majority in this medium. And so, you know, the government is very much invested in making sure that the
right.
ideas and the ideology of the ruling class is the only ideology and the only narrative that gets perpetuated and that gets airwaves. So, you know, it's enormously important for us to understand that. And the way Glenn broke it down is important too, because he says a gold rush for corporations. Well, what that means, it's a gold rush for the capitalists, for the ruling class. In other words, the rich are going to continue to get richer, and you and I are going to continue to get fucked, all for the sake of private profit. All right, the profit of the already rich. Now, one thing that Glenn said that we all need to understand, and we all need to be very clear about what Glenn said and why he said it and what it means. He said that the job description of a public official, and he was talking about President Obama, so he's talking about the office of the president, not the individual Barack Obama, because this has been, it's been this way for, you know, for the last 200 plus years. But the office of the chief executive of this country is to facilitate the efficient dispensing of public resources to private interests. I'm so grateful that Glenn breaks it down like that, because that is a classic definition of what a chief executive does, the role of the chief executive, i.e. the president, does in a capitalist economy. All right? That's another one of the myths, the great myths of Americanism, is that, you know, the president is, you know, is elected by the people, and, you know, the government is by the people and for the people and all that crap. It's a lot of, it's just, you know, it's a myth. It's an absolute myth. And so when we really see what goes on, all right, as opposed to the rhetoric, as opposed to the talk, as opposed to the mythology, when we see what really goes on, this FCC ruling is definitive of that job description. All right. The chief executive's job is to facilitate the dispensing of public resources to private interests. Now, if you think I'm crazy, let's turn back the clock, not too far, to these bailouts. It started under George Bush Jr. and then continued under Barack Obama, to the tune of how many hundreds of trillions of dollars, Solomon? I mean, I don't think anybody has a clear idea of just how much money. I mean, the money is in the trillions, tens of trillions of dollars. I mean, obscene amounts of money were literally handed over to the financial institutions, to the banks and the corporations of this country. And that is the money that belongs to the people of the United States. That was public funds. Public funds were used to bail out private enterprises, all right? Now, and then they want to turn around and they want to say that's socialism. Now, you know, I mean, what could be more ridiculous? But at any rate, that is the job description of the chief executive. And I want to say, I just want to make another sidebar comment in terms of the role of the chief executive, the president. I am so sick and tired of hearing people refer to the president as the commander in chief. All right, and we've heard that since September of 2011, since this overwhelming wave of militarism has taken our country, that the president is our commander-in-chief. No, he's not. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. That is a tiny, tiny fraction of the 300 million people that make up this country. You know, those are the those are the men and women that are in the armed forces, in the military service. He is their commander-in-chief, not ours. He's not your commander in chief, Solomon. He's not mine. He's not yours. If you're listening out there and you're not employed by the military, so that's another rhetorical adjustment that we need to make. Is to understand that the president of the United States is not our commander in chief. No, he's not. But at any rate, his role in his office primarily is, as Lynn Ford said, to facilitate the dispensing of public resources to private interests. Well, what does that mean? That's thievery is what that is, and the only way it can happen is under the guise of what, the free market. All right, that's what that language does, is it covers up thievery of public money, of public resources. That's what capitalism does. That's what this free market mythology does, is it masks the thievery, the outright robbery of public resources and what is the commonwealth. You know, it's interesting. If you look at the letterhead from, if the governor of Virginia or the governor of Kentucky sends you a letter, the letterhead at the top of his the paper that he sends it on will say, you know, the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Kentucky. There was a time when we thought of our geopolitical unit as a commonwealth. In other words, you know, that people get together in order to share the wealth that exists among us so that we all can benefit. But that's not the way it works out in a capitalist society. The wealth is not common. The wealth is private. The misery is common, all right? The misery and the poverty is what the vast majority of people get. The profit and the luxury is what a very, very tiny fraction of Americans get, the ruling class. And so another part of that, Solomon, is the breaking of promises. You know, I love the way Glenn framed it. He said, you know, there was there was never a promise that Barack Obama wouldn't break.
Right.
Yeah, you know, but that's also part, and, you know, and obviously he's not the first president, just the most recent, you know, just the current one. And, I mean, it's a byword in our society, you know, that politicians are liars, right? I mean, it's become proverbial because it's just so true. And that is also part of the rhetorical ethic of Americanism that I referred to earlier about lies just being another one of the threads that make up the fabric of Americanism. It's just lies and misinformation and untruths and mythology. You know, that, I mean, nobody expects the president to keep his promises. I mean, how come Americans aren't in the, out in the streets, you know, after Barack Obama broke his promise about single-payer health care, national health care, or now this net neutrality ruling and all these other things? Because
they've been pacified.
That's a big part of it. They're pacified by it, and they're just, you know, and it's nothing new. It's business as usual. The massive Americans are thoroughly pacified, thoroughly disinterested, and part of that is it's just business as usual. It's nothing new. And so, you know, we see a lot of things going on with this FCC ruling. I'm glad you broke it down the way you did, and I just wanted to add a few other angles to it to understand it as part of what I referred to earlier as the cultural DNA of Americanism. You know, we see elements of that in this whole FCC ruling. I mean, it doesn't behoove the ruling class and the government that we have a public media that has vitality and vigor and participation. Absolutely not. It behooves the government and the ruling class, which really is one and the same. It behooves them to have a monopoly and a small minority that controls the airwaves, that controls the information that flows in and around this country. And it's frightening, it's startling, it's alarming just how misinformed most Americans are, even those Americans who like to think that they're informed, you know, that they watch the news, that they read the paper, without realizing that most news broadcasts, most newspapers and news periodicals are largely propaganda. And they're written from a very elite perspective, the perspective of the ruling class, and so it's one of those major chords in the fabric of Americanism. You know, we've touched on a couple already tonight: militarism, and now the public discourse, and so the FCC piece is something that we need to keep track of as it develops.
Right, and here's the thing, you know, folks that might not think that you know, it matters. You know, your tax dollars, you know, go towards funding the the spectrum and the as well as the airwaves that are doled out by the FCC to the likes of News Corporation, a la Fox News, NBC, Universal, General Electric, I should say, you know, that owns the parent company to NBC, Universal, MSNBC, and so forth. You know, it's our tax dollars that go towards funding those airwaves and the spectrum that's used, you know, for the broadband and all that stuff. That's doled out by the FCC. Now, it's the corporations that have the money to build the infrastructure and the affiliates all over the place. But it's our tax dollars that go towards that. So that's why it matters. And then going back to even the 1934 Communications Act, and then before that, the 1927-28 Radio Act, when those acts were created, the understanding was for the likes of NBC at that time and the others was that if you were to be granted these radio licenses and even later down the line television licenses from the FCC funded by taxpayer dollars, you had to provide a certain amount of localism. You had to provide a certain amount of localism in terms of news and information. And they break that rule all the time. They break that rule all the time. They provide the most scant localism as you can possibly find. And that's why you have so many Americans running around confused about their communities, confused about the world, and confused about one another, where, you know, it's something that has to be, we have to remember, we have to be vigilant in this, and you have to go to websites like Industry Airs, Airs as in E-A-R-S, go to Industry Airs. They're a great site. You can go in there and you can actually, they have some links to how to file complaints directly to FCC dockets, because a lot of folks don't even know where to find it, because if you go to the FCC website, it's very hard to find the docket in terms of how to complain. They've made it very easy on places like Industry Airs and also freepress.net. Those are places you can go to file complaints. You know what I'm saying? You know, even like, you know, for instance, like with the radio, when you listen to radio, that corporate crap that you hear, you know, in your local area, you know, especially like the hip hop stations, you know, they're not even supposed to have profanity on between, you know, 10 p.m. and I believe it's 7 or 8 a.m. in the morning, but they break that all the time. A lot of complaints are not coming in. Like, you know, it's important to go there, file those complaints, and to think that, and if you think that they don't make a difference, was it 2008, 2009, there was a major, major drive nationwide, and you had folks having town hall meetings throughout the country. And there's a great documentary that kind of charts that called, it's called the Broadcast Blues. And you had forums, town hall forums in places like Seattle, Washington, D.C., I mean, across the country, where people came and they demanded the FCC commissioners attend these. And so they made tons and tons of complaints. And it, believe it or not, it made, you know what I'm saying, it made a little bit of a difference. I mean, you had an engaged populace. People are coming out and really a lot, just really expressing themselves in terms of their disgust and their disdain for the direction that media was going in this country. So it's important, because when each one of those dockets, they have to be read, they have to be monitored. But if you're not making these, if you're not making these complaints the same way, if you're abused by police officers or you're harassed by police officers, if you're not observing like their what their badge number are and writing those letters, because every letter that you send in terms of a complaint towards the police department in your local area has to be filed, and it develops a paper trail. Now much more has to be done, as Peter said, to towards dismantling a system, an institutionally like racist and unjust system like policing in America, the prison system, the so-called justice system, and even how media is done. But, you know, we need to, you know, start and become as broad as possible. We have to our method of attacking the beast, plural, has to be as diversified as possible. It has to be by air, land, and sea, proverbially. So, you know, but, you know, Peter, you know, since, you know, before I go to the next clip, because you talk so much about Obama and him being commander in chief, and I just wanted to read this, you know, kind of outline this to folks before I go to this next bar clip. Since 1998, about early 1999, I would say military spending in this country in America has grown about 9% at a 9% clip above the total inflation of like the last I guess the last decade, and you compare that to 1.3% per year of domestic discretionary programs. So when you look at domestic discretionary programs, you know, healthcare, education is considered a discretionary program. We're looking at growth has been about 1.3% compared to the 9% of military growth. But then when you look at the total increase of the Pentagon budget since 2001, since Peter highlighted September 2001, when you look at the total increase of the Pentagon's budget since 2001, it's been 73%, and that's not including spending on Iraq and Afghanistan. So excluding, save Iraq and Afghanistan, it's been 73% increase of the total Pentagon budget. Wow, 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 wow. And here's our buddy Obama. And this is right on time with Glenn Ford and making the connection to Obama. So many people's man, that so many people drunk on that Obama Kool-Aid still continue to support this dude, despite the fact that they protested bloody hell for Bush's illegal wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But this dude, they are complicitly just, you know, zombies to, and just basically a bunch of sycophants. So here's Glenn Ford and Obama's war.
On Capitol Hill, resistance to U.S. militarism has all but collapsed, and the Republican majority in the U.S. House has not even arrived yet. With no opposition whatsoever in the Senate and only 48 nay votes in the House, the Congress last week passed the biggest military budget since the end of World War II. Only 42 Democrats, including just 12 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, dared to defy their warmongering president and compliant House leadership. From the moment that Barack Obama won the Democratic nomination, we at Black Agenda Report have been predicting that he would become the most pro-war president in modern American history. Forget about Obama's phony rhetoric. The proof is in the numbers. The military budget firmly cements Barack Obama's place as the biggest pro-war president in two generations. Today, the United States, although it is the world's only superpower, spends almost as much as all of the rest of the world's militaries combined. The U.S. defense authorization for 2011 is $725 billion. China, with the second most expensive military machine on the planet, spends less than $80 billion a year. If Barack Obama lasts for 8 years in office, he is on track to spend $5 trillion on the Pentagon, significantly more than George Bush, who in turn spent a lot more than Ronald Reagan. But, as they say on the TV commercials, that's not all. The defense budget doesn't include expenditures for Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs, nuclear weapons work at the Department of Energy, military aid to other countries through the Department of State, NASA space programs that are really military projects, the military retirement funds run out of the Department of Treasury, and the interest payments on past military expenditures that were financed by debt. Inclusion of those hidden costs of war would bring military-related spending to well over $1 trillion a year and rising all the time. In real dollars, the U.S. is spending far more on the military than at any time during the Cold War, when there was another superpower in competition, and more than President Lyndon Johnson spent at the height of the Vietnam War. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. broke with LBJ over that war, in part because he knew, in Dr. King's words, that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. Under the first black president, that military suction tube is far bigger and more destructive than in Dr. King's day, while the economic crisis is arguably much worse, threatening the very viability of black America as a national community. Yet only 12 black members of Congress can bring themselves to vote against Obama's wars. And the black misleadership class in general demands that African Americans sacrifice their own economic survival interests to Barack Obama's political interests. Obama is not merely a continuation of the Bush administration's war policies. He has accelerated the descent into a war economy. That is nothing for any black person to be proud about. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So, Peter, I thought he was that was right on time. I mean, I have nothing more to say than that. I mean, that just kind of buttresses everything that we were talking about. But it's you know, folks, it's nonsense. You know, and you know, I don't want to hear any of this. This talk that, you know, if we don't vote for Obama in 2012, then because he is going to run again, and if we don't vote for him in 2012, then that means it's going to make way for the likes of Sarah Palin or Newt Gingrich or Tim Pawlenty or whoever they decide, whoever the Republicans decide to run. I mean, it hasn't, you know, it has, you know, We have to understand that voting Democrat and voting Democrat in 2008, you may think it did a lot, but we still continue to see unemployment at astronomical rates. You know, it's listed at 9.8%, but really the accurate number is about 17.6% unemployment. And no, that can't simply be attributed to Obama, but it, you know, because it started with Bush and, you know, you know, before that, but Obama hasn't done anything towards that. We continue to see things that matter in our lives, like police brutality, go unabated, unchecked. And yes, that's a systemic thing that has occurred under every major president, every president going back to good old George Washington, the scumbag he was, going back to George Washington, who owned slaves, all the way to this point where we still see black people systematically oppressed. Obama has moved away, has clearly moved away from that. He made his marked words, his methodic words in 2008 the summer of 2008 when he said we should not protest the police murder of Sean Bell. I mean, he has made it clear that he's not going to say anything about black unemployment, you know, even though it's the highest in this nation, you know, compared to whites and Latinos. He would not even address that, would not even address black unemployment, and basically said that he could, you know, he wants to raise wanted to quote Reagan, you know, and raise the tide to lift all the boats. But if Peter is in a yacht and I'm in a dinghy, you know, an air-filled dinghy, you know, it doesn't matter how much you raise the damn water. I'm still in a dinghy, and you're in a yacht. And, you know, so these are things that continue to to be unabated and unchallenged, because he's interested in his reelection. He's not interested in being a change maker. And I mean, we don't have universal health care. He made a stance on that. He moved away. He moved away from that and sided with the major healthcare industry. Matter of fact, so much so that the healthcare bill was partly written by healthcare industry lobbyists. I mean, so the wars are going on unchecked, and the wars do affect you, because the money that goes into these wars is money that is not going into your community. And right. So, you know, it's just a joke. And we look at, you know what I'm saying, we look at Guantanamo. It's still open. I mean, he says he's going to shut it, and it's still open. He could shut it with an executive order. He could shut Guantanamo with an executive order. He could absolutely shut it, and he said that he was going to shut it when he came in, you know what I'm saying? And it's still open, and we still have people that are languishing in Guantanamo who do not belong there. If you think, or anyone thinks, that all the people that in Guantanamo were terrorists or conspirators, you know what I'm saying, to commit terrorism against the U.S., you're kidding yourself. There are people that were released by the U.S. government after serving years in Guantanamo, and you know what I'm saying, and some serving several months in Guantanamo, being tortured, and they were released by the U.S. when they found, oops, yep, you're innocent, you shouldn't be there, oops, Syrian man, you know, oops, you shouldn't be there. I mean, so it's going on unchecked. It is absolutely ridiculous, and the fact that people, you know what I'm saying, some people, you know, were picked up on the field of battle, and so what would happen if, for instance, say the Taliban, you know, or some so-called insurgents picked up, you know, Peter, U.S. Military on the battlefield and kept them. The U.S. would be going nuts. You know what I'm saying? What, they're held in a Taliban prison or such and such prison? You know what I'm saying? Those prisoners, I mean, they'd be going nuts, and it's crazy. You know what I'm saying? You know, a crime's committed on the battlefield, to say that they're gonna be tried in a military tribunal or even a civilian court. I mean, it's ludicrous, man. But we don't even think about these things. It's ludicrous. And some of these, as we know, some of these individuals, like the 16-year-old boy that was picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan, and
right.
Just recently, you know what I'm saying, sentenced. I mean, decades, man. It is crazy, but these things are all connected to Obama. This is his war now. He has taken Afghanistan, taken the ownership, up the ante, sent, you know, 30,000-40,000 new troops there. I mean, invested all this kind of money. It's a war that cannot be won. You know what I'm saying? The U.S. cannot win a ground war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And as we know, you know, they continue to drop bombs within the first 72 hours. Of Obama being in office. I mean, he started executing multiple drone attacks from these Predator drones, dropping, missiles indiscriminately onto, you know, villages left and right. People, if you haven't seen Rethink Afghanistan, have it, you know, get the movie, you know, rent it or show it from online to your friends in a community center. I mean, it's crazy where the average, the for each military personnel of each soldier on the ground in Afghanistan per year, it costs $900,000. $900,000. $900,000 to finance one soldier for 1 year in Afghanistan. All right. So you multiply that by about 45,000. All right. Ground troops that we have there. It's crazy, man. It is crazy. And we continue to support this dude. If this is what the kind of, you know what I'm saying? And we want to juxtapose his face next to King's on these stupid T-shirts and this, that, and the other. King wouldn't be down with these wars. He said the U.S. is the greatest purveyor of violence, you know, on the face of the earth. He said any nation that continues to spend more money militarily than it does on programs for social uplift is headed for spiritual doom. And you think that he'd be down with Obama, and you have the audacity to buy a trendy shirt that has
right.
his face juxtaposed next to Obama's? Are you kidding yourself? You are you are part of the problem as well. You're continuing the propaganda, the obfuscation that is confusing young black and brown-skinned boys and girls to thinking that there is a comparison to be made beyond a phenotypical one between Obama and Dr. King. There is none to be made ideologically, none whatsoever. King would have never told people not to engage in civil disobedience over the murder of a young 20-something plus year old man named Sean Bell. You know what I'm saying? Would have never, ever told people not to. He wouldn't have told them to riot or anything like that. But the people weren't rioting. They were in the streets protesting, marching. He would have never told them to stop. And Obama had the nerve to talk, whatever. And that's a young man, and people, shame on you, because most of us that are black know somebody that's been hemmed up by the cops unwarrantedly in our communities. And Obama said to you, no, respect the judge and his decision, despite the fact that these three police officers filled him with 50 bullets. This is just one of the many things that this guy has endorsed. Come on, people, we have to wake up. Wake up. This is all connected. You know what I'm saying? Political prisoners. And I'll end on this. I mean, when we see two political prisoners that we thank God, you know, the Scott sisters, you know, are going to be released soon. Hopefully they're going to be released soon. But that racist, you know, pig down there, Haley Barbour, it just released. And he didn't do it on his own. It's because, you know, he's trying to make some political maneuvers after the statement, you know, the gaffe he had a couple weeks ago speaking honestly, his honesty saying that, you know, segregation, that didn't bother me in the 60s, it didn't bother my community. So anyways, you know, thank goodness the Scott sisters and are being released, and Jamie Scott, you know, these are two black women that got sentenced, double life sentences for an alleged $11 crime, and they got sentenced, and they had no priors. They had no priors on them whatsoever, no prior offenses, and they got double life sentences apiece, all right, and they served 16 years, and they're supposed to be getting out soon. And Jamie Scott has renal failure, that's kidney failure, and the pardon is basically for that. So, folks, man, but they're not the only political prisoners out there, man. That, you know, and, you know, we have, for instance, the Cuban Five. We have Black Panthers that are languishing in prisons right now, such as Marshall Eddie Conway. Chip Fitzgerald, and these are individuals, these are black men and women who are sitting in prisons right now because of their activity against an oppressive government that was, you know, wrecking terrorism on black communities, you know what I'm saying? And they're languishing in prisons right now, and you look at the Cuban Five, they're sitting in prisons because basically they're doing what the U.S. government does every day in other countries, goes and sends out spies in other countries to find, you know, to spy on so-called individuals and groups and organizations that might be plotting and planning terrorist attacks on their country. And that's what the Cuban Five, they went to Miami, and they were basically scouting out these right-wing, you know, Miami, you know, financed, you know, anti-Castro, anti-Cuba revolution individuals and groups in Miami that were plotting, you know, attacks against, you know, subversive attacks against the Cuban government, and they get hemmed up. And I mean, it's madness, Peter. It's madness. I'm at a loss of words for once.
Well, it is madness. And, you know, just one comment with regard to the Scott sisters, you know, Those two black women are emblematic of the mistreatment and the maltreatment that black women receive in this country. And most of the black women who are trampled upon in this country are not behind bars. They're not serving life sentences like the Scott sisters. But black females continue to be the most oppressed group in the United States of America. And I want to, there's some work that the progressive scholar Manning Marable has done, and some of the actual data is a little bit dated at this point. But I want to commend another book to our listeners with regard to the treatment of women of color in this country. And beyond that, there's a lot more in it than that. But the book is called How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America. And chapter 3 is about the exploitation of black women in this country. And so in the broader context of the exploitation of black women in this country, the Scott Sisters, that's just one case. That's just one example of millions. And one of the things that Marable cites is that one-third of black women in this country are officially classified as in poverty. One-third, one out of three black females are in poverty. And so, it's absolutely scandalous. It's absolutely scandalous the way women of color are exploited and oppressed and annihilated in this country. So the case with the Scott Sisters is an extreme case because they were imprisoned, that unthinkable and egregious conviction in the kangaroo court is just definitive. It's a definitive example and case of how black women are mistreated in this country. But
yeah.
Going back to what Glenn was talking about in terms of the biggest military budget, and there's a lot there to talk about. I just want to touch on a couple things. The biggest military budget since World War II. What jumped into my mind with that statement? Who was the president during World War II? What party was Roosevelt affiliated with? The Democrats. What party is Obama affiliated with? The Democrats. Those are the two presidents who presided over the largest military budgets, the largest war expenditures of all time, of the history of the United States of America. But what is the common stereotype in the public discourse of Democratic presidents? That they're weak on the military, right? And that's one of the things that got Ronald Reagan elected, was the way that Jimmy Carter was disparaged for being weak on the military. That's one of the things that got George Bush elected in 2000. Well, he wasn't elected, but that was one of the things that they campaigned on, was how Republican presidents are more inclined to support the military. So there's a whole lot there, but. And I want to come back to some statistics that we're left with regard to, this goes back to the top of the show in terms of the relationship between health care and guns or butter. And we'll come back to that. But I want to see if we can take this caller first, Solomon.
Yeah, it looks like we have a caller, at least if not from Michigan, with a Michigan area code. Caller, quick comments or questions?
No, I'm just listening right now.
Oh, you're just listening in? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, cool.
That's
cool. Let me go on. Let me try to continue this train of thought in terms of the relationship between our Commonwealth, the common welfare, our welfare as a people, and the budget that goes to the military. First of all, the other thing that comes to mind, is this unfathomable amount of money, $725 billion, the current Pentagon budget, and like you said, Solomon, that does not include all these other military related costs, NASA, veterans expenditures, these so called hidden costs that really take the budget over $1 trillion. So that's just
like nuclear weapons.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another indication of how lies and fabrications and obfuscation is the order of the day when it comes to information in this country. The budget's $725 billion. Well, no, it's not. It's really over $1 trillion. Let's just be honest about it and put all those costs together, all that stuff goes eventually and finally into the pentagram. Oops, I mean the Pentagon. And so, you know, you know, just, that's just another area where there's just no honesty and no integrity in terms of what that money's all about. It's $1 trillion plus. That is what is, that's the priority of the United States government. That's the priority of the ruling class. So where does that leave the rest of us? Here's some recent statistics from that radically liberal organization, the U.S. Census Bureau. But anyway, the U.S. Census Bureau reports, and these are real latest statistics from the Census Bureau, from 2009, there were more than 10 million low-income working families in the United States. 10 million families that were classified officially as low-income. Okay, and that was an increase of nearly 250,000 families from 2008. What that means is 45 million people, and that including 22 million children, lived in low-income working families, which was a bump of 1.7 million people from the previous year of 2008. 43% of working families that had at least one minority parent, a parent of color, were low-income. 43%, so more than 4 out of 10 minority families were classified as low income. Income inequality continued to grow with the richest 20%. Now, this is comparatively now, okay? We just, all right, all these families living in poverty compared with the richest 20% of working families taking home 47% of all income, all right, and earning 10 times the amount of low-income working families. Now, before I go forward with that, I just want to make the statement that the figure that the federal government comes up for what's low-income, all right, or what's poverty, is a fraud in the first place, all right? So what and so what I mean, what the Census Bureau means when they say low-income is a family that's at 200% of the poverty level. So they're not technically living in poverty, but they're considered low-income, which really is living in poverty. If we look at the statistics with any kind of integrity and any kind of honesty, so what that means is as Glenn Ford says, Barack Obama is presiding over a society that is descending into a permanent war economy. We talked about that at the top of the show in terms of militarism. The United States is a society of permanent war. It's not a question anymore. This is speculation. This country is at war permanently. Tell me what's going on in Iraq. Tell me what's going on in Afghanistan. Speaking of Afghanistan, the Pentagon itself has come out with a statement that there are roughly 100 members of Al-Qaeda running around in Afghanistan. Well, from what I understand, that's what the whole mission is about, is to root out Al-Qaeda. Well, there's 100 members of Al-Qaeda. And how many troops, Solomon? 45,000 or more, along with the mercenary forces, at $900,000 per soldier per year. To get 100 Afghan citizens who are part of Al Qaeda. Now, you do the math on that. You figure out the calculus and tell me if that's really about a war on terror. Again, it's a lie, it's a ruse, it's a fraud. So we have to ask the question, what does it mean to win the war? When are the troops going to be pulled out of those countries? When is the president going to declare war, a victory? Well, we know that George Bush Jr. declared the end of all military or combat operations. That's what he said, the end of all combat operations. Really? tell that to the Iraqis and the Afghans and even the American soldiers that combat operations have ceased. You know, it was a bald-faced lie, yet it was ballyhooed and celebrated. You know, this big to-do on top of an aircraft carrier when George got to dress up like G.I. Joe, you know, and they come out and they just put this lie out there. Oh, combat operations are over. All right, you know, again, another lie. We're supposed to just buy it and go about our business, go shopping, right? Well, we already know if we're honest with ourselves and we look at what's going on behind the scenes, we already know what winning the war is all about. Winning the war over there is about securing natural resources, is about securing access to the crude oil and the natural gas, among other natural resources that are underground in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then why do you think Iran is next on the list? Hello, Iran has some of the largest natural gas and crude oil reserves that are untapped on the planet. So, is that any coincidence that Iran all of a sudden is the next greatest threat to the planet? When's the last time Iran launched a war on anybody? Anyone? Anyone?
Yeah.
I don't think they ever have. Yeah, there was the Iran-Iraq war, but Iraq initiated that. You know, so Iran is a peaceful country, as opposed to the United States, which is a bellicose country that has been at permanent war with the rest of the planet for over 100 years. So winning the war is all about winning and securing resources for who? For you and for me, Solomon, for the brother that's on the line, for our listeners? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Are we going to share in the spoils of all these wonderful resources that are going to be exploited? No, American capital is. American capital, in other words, American corporations, private wealth, that 10% of the richest families in this country owning taking home 90% of the wealth. That's what those wars are about. And part of that victory is the state of permanent war, because we know that some of the most wealthy and some of the most influential corporations on the planet are military related corporations. All right, petrochemicals and weapons systems and now mercenary corporations. It is a permanent war economy because war is now a permanent feature of the United States of America. Now, the flip side of that, Solomon, is with the statistics that the Census Bureau just released, we can see that in addition to a permanent war economy, we have a permanent poverty economy. We have moved in the last several years into a permanent state of underemployment in the United States. And, you know, the booming 50s and 60s when American corporations were producing all kinds of things, and like automobiles and steel and tires and televisions and all these things, that era is long gone. That era is over. American corporations, that is American capital, has found it expedient to move their operations overseas so that they can pay their workers less money, so that they don't have to put up with those pesky unions, so they don't have to pay those benefits and health care and things like that to those people who produce the wealth for them. So what does this economy produce, Solomon? What does the United States economy produce? What does it manufacture? What does it make? Weapons is what it makes. Guns and missiles and bombs and war is what it makes. In addition to those things, we see we can pull up economists and we can pull up economic journals if we want to get technical. But we see the financialization of the economy in the United States. So in addition to a permanent war economy, there's also a permanent finance economy. Now, what that means is one of the other things that the U.S. economy produces are not tangible items. It's not things like refrigerators and cars and automobiles and tires and steel anymore. It's these finance vehicles, you know, mortgages, loans, and then speculation and all these Wall Street tricks and shenanigans that we've seen get unveiled over the last several years that have taken this economy, not just the U.S. economy, but the entire global economy, to the brink of disaster, which is why the government had to steal the American citizens' money to bail out the banks and the financial institutions. It's because we live in this upside-down society now where there's permanent war, permanent under and unemployment, permanent poverty and an economy that doesn't produce anything tangible other than, you know, fast food and, things like that. So we are seeing an absolute destruction, of the American economy, and by extension, a destruction of the American society. Unfortunately, most Americans refuse to see the reality, and we see this God bless America, rah rah, patriotism continues to be the order of the day. And you know, we talked about militarism and how it's part of the civil religion of Americanism. And how is it that Americans continue to support the beast of militarism to the tune of $1 trillion a year when the results are poverty and misery and underemployment and unemployment? How is it? Well, it's because Americans are brainwashed, and that militarism and nationalism are trumpeted at every turn. This time of year, in addition to the holidays and so forth, what does that bring in terms of sports? I used to be a big fan of sports. I've tried to divest myself of that. But I know this time of the year is time for playoffs in the National Football League, and it's the time of the year for the bowl games in college. And it doesn't take a scientist to unearth what the connection between militarism and professional sports in this country, professional and collegiate sports in this country. You know, you look at ever since September 2001, you ever notice on the back of the helmets of football players at the college and pro level that there's a flag, a United States flag on the helmet? Same thing with basketball players, with baseball players. I mean, there is this enmeshment of militarism into sports. And so a populace that is underemployed and unemployed and in poverty and in misery, one of the things they turn to for an escape, for entertainment, is sports. And when sports is another conduit for the elevation and exaltation of militarism and war, then we're just getting hammered at every turn. Even turning on a football game, you know, we have to watch, you know, the planes fly over the stadium, and you know, and the general out there flipping the was it a couple years ago in the Super Bowl, one of the generals who was one of the commanding generals in Iraq and Afghanistan theater over there was the honorary coin toss before the Super Bowl. What the hell is that about, Solomon? So we're seeing militarism become part of the fabric of our society. What's the number one selling video game on the market today?
Yeah, Black Ops.
Warcraft.
Exactly. And some of the numbers you were talking about, Peter, just to give folks some context, National Priorities Project, you know, did something great. They broke things down by county and municipality. And so, for instance, there's a county right outside of Maryland, right outside of D.C. called Montgomery County. Yeah. And, for instance, the money that we spend, for instance, when they broke it down, like, in terms of the money that is spent, like the $700+ billion that's spent. I mean, that obviously it's much more than that. It's above a trillion. But just looking at the baseline, $700 billion, $770 billion that is spent discretionarily, you know, on military by the U.S. government per year, and then you break that down by county per capita, that would mean that $3 billion are not going towards Montgomery County. And so that $3 billion, you know, that could go to that county alone would amount to renewable electricity. Like, if the money was not going towards military, like that county alone, that county, Montgomery County, Maryland, that money could go to $2.8 million homes in that area
towards renewable electricity.
Right.
It could go towards 16,338 affordable housing units. It could go towards 1.2 million children having health care for 1 year. Those are kind of things that it would go towards. And we look at Afghanistan, some of the other numbers that Peter and I didn't talk about with Afghanistan. We look at for a gallon of gas in Afghanistan, for a gallon of gas for U.S. military vehicles, Jeeps, Humvees, those types of things, it's $400 per gallon of gas, per gallon of petrol. All right, $400 per gallon of petrol. The U.S. military spending in Afghanistan. All right, that's some of the wise ways that Peter's tax dollars are being doled out, and that's the proper term. They're being doled out. I mean, it's the military welfare. I mean. These conservatives want to talk about welfare or something like that. That's robbing us, whatever. They never talk about the corporate welfare and the military welfare that's robbing us of X, Y, and Z. You know, and those are some of the things that we have to address. And Peter, and it just doesn't. And we're just talking about the military, but when we even look, we're just talking about the military. There's another large industry in America that steals and robs not just us of humanity, but of economic resource, and that's the prison industrial complex, the new age slavery. I mean, hundreds of billion dollar industry, and
right.
One of my very very good friends happens to be one of the preeminent PhD professors in this country that does progressive radical work. Around this, that's my man, Dr. Joseph Richardson, who will go unheralded, because of the work that he does. It's unpopular, but he does some tremendous work around this area, and you want to talk about the robbing. You know what I'm saying? The vast, like, just robbing of resources. I mean, look at other countries. I mean, other countries don't come close to the number of people that are incarcerated, per capita, and also just sheer number. No other country comes close, even sheer number of people being incarcerated in this country. This country incarcerates more black men in this country than at the height of apartheid South Africa. We can go on, and it's something like near and dear to my heart, because I do a lot of work. You know what I'm saying, with prison reform, working with young men who are incarcerated. And I have had an opportunity to go and do work in places like San Quentin, and we're not putting money into rehabilitation. Why? Because because there's no profit in the cure. The profit is to allow it to go on, so these men get released and they recidivate and they go back in. When you have $1 billion an industry that is on the stock market with the likes of Wackenhut and Geo Group, Geo Group is what Wackenhut used to be, and CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, when it's on Wall Street, you can't have an uncorrupt system. You can't have a system that is just it means that this system is motivated by money, so people are not going to invest resources towards rehabilitation, whereas other countries throughout the world, they invest resources into rehabilitation, and that's where their recidivism rate is so low. And we also talked about, and to jump on the next thing, the nuclear weapons, which you talked about, Peter, that's not a part of the military budget. That's in the Department of Energy. There are 24,000 nuclear warheads on the planet Earth right now, and 23,000 of those 24,000 nuclear weapons are either in the U.S. or Russia. The rest of the world amounts to the other 1,000. So the other 1,000 go to all the other countries that have nuclear weapons, in their arsenal. China, Pakistan, India, Israel, obviously. But the U.S. has more than 12,000 nuclear weapons in its arsenal. And, and we look at the START treaty that was just so-called, the scaling down the so-called scaling down of nuclear weapons. I mean, you're still, the U.S., once even scale this down, you know, by the time, you know, and it's going to take place over, you know, well over a decade, you know, once they scale that down, it's still an ungodly amount of nuclear weapons that is still going to be in existence. I mean, it's humanity is being robbed, and because of that, we have no perspective. And so people mark certain things as victories and triumphs because they've been robbed of perspectives and perspectives of history, and their minds have been monopolized and so forth. That's why people jump and cheer for the health care bill. They jump and cheer for the friggin', you know, tax, you know, the extension of the Bush tax cuts, you know, in terms of the compromise that was set forth, because there is no perspective, and that's why, Peter, it's simple. I mean, it's not a surprise to me when we talk about why Americans are not protesting like they were and are in Greece and in Ireland and Spain and so forth, is because Americans don't understand. They you know what I'm saying? These other countries are fighting. They're protesting for more of their more government spending on social services. We're over here like a bunch of nitwits, you know what I'm saying, allowing the Tea Party and the conservatives to push us in direction where we, you know, where people are protesting against their own interests for less government spending on social services, while at the same time not talking about less spending on military. It's absurd.
Yeah, it's a total upside down. It's a bizarre world, you know. And as you rattled off some of those essential elements of civilization that are being deprived of people because of the military expenditures just in Montgomery County, things like housing, healthcare, utilities, and then we looked at the prison industrial complex or the prison slavery complex. Where there is no rehabilitation, there is no re-education, there's no drug treatment to speak of that will keep inmates from recidivating, and none of those things are you know, there's no diversion and no prevention and drug treatment to prevent people from becoming, you know, inmates in the first place. And now think about it. So what's the mantra of the ruling class? What is the regressive or conservative mantra? Government's role is not to provide people with housing. It's not to provide people with health care. It's not to provide people with utilities. It's not to provide rehabilitation for prisoners. It's not to provide education or re-education for prisoners or offenders. It's not to provide drug treatment for people who are in a situation where they've abused substances. Now, is that any coincidence that at the same time those retirement benefits, or you name it, those things that you talk about, you know, the social services, is it any coincidence, Solomon, that the regressive mantra of the ruling class is that, you know, that's not the role of government to provide those things for people, yet and still it is the role of government to pour $1 trillion a year into the military, into a state of permanent warfare, into a permanent war economy? Do you see what's happening here? You see this rhetorical change here? That's what's being repeated over these airwaves. And again, it goes back to this FCC thing and the control of the airwaves. That's why it doesn't behoove the ruling class and the federal government to have a lot of public media and a lot of voices out there that challenge the dominant narrative and the dominant ideas of the ruling class, because people would be calling that into question. They would be saying, well, yes, it is the role of government to provide some semblance of housing and health care and utilities and rehabilitation and education and drug treatment to its citizens. That's what the common welfare is all about. That's what commonwealth is. That's the whole concept of a society. You know, there was a time when government, the whole concept of government was people governing themselves, but what the regressives have done over the last, well, it goes back to really the Goldwater years in the early 60s, and it really took center stage with the ascendancy of Reagan in the 80s. you know, was this idea that, and Reagan said it verbatim, government's not the solution, government's the problem. You know, so there's this, now the mantra of the ruling class is that government is the problem, and so what that does is, and this goes back to the top of the show, Solomon, when I was talking about some of the ideological DNA of Americanism, where we parcel things into a dualistic worldview. It's good versus bad. The government has now become part of the bad. All right, so government is bad. So anytime the government steps in to do anything, it's bad because it's the government. Once the government has been put into the camp that's bad, the bad guys, like the cowboys and Indians movies, the Indians are permanently in the camp of bad guys. So that's just the way they are. All right, that's it. That's the way the world is in the American imagination. Indians are bad guys. Cowboys are good guys. Now what they did is they took it, and it's a cruel coincidence. It's a cruel joke. It's a cruel irony that the who presided over that whole transition was was Ronald Reagan, who was a B movie actor in some of those corny old westerns, right? And here he is, and in 1980, actually at the pinnacle of power in the United States, turning that whole idea, that whole stereotypical ideology against the government. So this idea of government as the bad guys. So no, housing, that's not the role of government because government's bad. Healthcare, no, government has no role in healthcare because government's bad. You know, so it's part of that ideology. And people buy it because it gets repeated and it gets repeated and it gets repeated. And Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and all those other jackasses on the regressive airwaves repeat that stuff, and Americans buy it up. They soak it up like sponges, Solomon. And so and they're unable to have – they don't have a critical filter through which to deconstruct all these lies and all these fabrications that they're being spoon-fed. And so this is what we end up with. We end up with people believing that government is bad, and government needs to, and so government needs to stay out of everything, okay? But nobody questions the government's role in this permanent war. Nobody questions that. Nobody questions that. That's just part of what America is and what government does. So no, they don't want to kill the government. In fact, it was under the Republican administration, and Republicans are notorious, at least rhetorically, for talking about big government being bad, smaller government being better. What happened to the federal government under George Bush Jr.? It exploded in size. The Department of Homeland Security is an enormous monstrosity. And so the federal government has continued to grow in size, not decrease in size. You know, so it's utter hypocrisy for these regressives to talk about government being bad and we need to shrink it and all that other stuff. No, that's not what's happening. It's simply, and going back to what Glenn said, the role of public officials, and government's made up of what? Public officials. It's the role of public officials, the role of government, to parcel out public resources to private interests. So that's what the role of government is. In fact, and in practice, in a capitalist society, Solomon, is its role is to protect and further the interests of private capital, of corporations. And we see that over and over and over again throughout American history. We see that from Shays' Rebellion. We see it to the Whiskey Rebellion. We see it in the Ludlow Massacre. We see it right up to what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan today. It's the federal government acting on behalf of corporations and private capital to use violence to further the interests of private capital and the wealthy elite. That's what's going on. You know, and let me just throw out one statistic before I hand it back to you. With all the public misery that we've just laid out with these statistics from the Census Bureau and from other sources about the humanity that's being robbed, the resources that are being robbed, you know, the how many millions of people have lost their homes with this mortgage crisis, and how many millions of people have lost their jobs, you know, and how many jobs continue. Let me just give you this one. From 2007 to 2009, the U.S. economy lost over 8.3 million jobs. They just evaporated. They're gone. So over 8 million Americans lost their jobs over the course of 2 years, Solomon. And the government is making how many jobs? You know, what, they make 30,000 jobs a year. You know, and those are very skewed figures too, because most of those are like part-time jobs and fast food jobs and low-wage jobs and things like that. So all the while, this misery is being spread around, and the American working class is being plunged into poverty and in a state of permanent underemployment. Listen to this. 2010 is expected to be the second most profitable year for Wall Street investment firms on record. The biggest five banks, which are J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup, those five banks, between them, have put aside at least $90 billion for year-end bonuses that they're going to give out to their executives. $90 billion are going to go to a handful of executives in the finance sector. Just, that's not salary. That's not wages. That's just bonuses. That's just money that they're just giving to them. Okay? On top of, you know, we've heard this figure just over the last several months, that U.S. corporations are sitting on top of, just sitting on, how much money? $1 trillion in cash. It's just sitting there. They're not spending it. They're not making new jobs with it. You know, they're not raising all everybody's boat with it. No, they're sitting on it. They're hoarding it. So what the wealthy are doing, what capitalism is doing, is they're hoarding their money, and they're handing out astronomical amounts of bonus in addition to the astronomical salaries that these people are given to a handful of people. You know, that's the ruling class. That's the sliver, the tiny sliver of well, very, very wealthy people at the top of the pyramid in this country. That's the reality. That's what's going on. And so it's absolutely diabolical. Absolutely diabolical. You know, and so we see things like the permanent war economy and the prison industrial system. These are areas of growth. Yeah, in addition to the war economy, in addition to the finance sector, you're right. The prison system continues to explode, you know, and why? Because there's a lot of people that are getting very wealthy off of it. So these are some of the trends, Solomon. You know, go back to, you know, where we started off in terms of what's happened in the year that's closing and what direction we're going in. We're going to continue to see the economy favor the ultra wealthy and do so through these predatory machinations like permanent war, like the prison industrial complex, and through the financialization of the economy. Basically, you know, what we refer to when we talk about Wall Street and the banksters. You know, that's the direction that this country is going into, and it's a very, very ugly direction. This country is going in a very, very ugly place.
All right. I want people to have our email address. If you're listening to us on archive or live, and you have some like ideas and you want to build, you know, please email us at yourworldnews2010@gmail.com. That's your YOUR world WORLD news NEWS 2010@gmail.com. Email us with ideas. If you have thoughts of maybe having some kind of community-centered radio event or something like that, but just even, you know, building. I mean, we have to. The forecast for 2011 looks very, very bleak based on a lot of different economists' projections.
you know, as we move forward to, you know, to 2011, 2012, that it's going to, you know, they say it's going to get worse before it gets better. And that's most likely the case. And you know, obviously most of us don't have the wherewithal financially to just up and leave and go to another country where it's, you know, they treat their citizens a lot better, more humanely. We just don't have the economic wherewithal. And so, you know, most of us are here, at least, you know, within the foreseeable future. And so it's imperative that, that, you know, we do what we can to mobilize in our communities. And so, you know, this is where the solutions-oriented things, you know, gears and ideas need to start moving forward, you know, and that includes myself and Peter. We don't claim to have all the ideas, but we do have ideas, and certainly you may have ideas. You know, I can't speak on behalf of your specific community in terms of what might work in terms of grassroots or organizing, because you know what's best for your community on the ground in terms of how to mobilize people, and that's where, you know, where, you know, you need to come in and to start to employ these ideas. And I think a great way is to have, you know, hosting things at local churches or community centers, open forums, dialogues, you know, getting people to understand critical issues better. And you can't, and just maybe just, you know, each meeting tackling one issue, looking at the prison industrial complex, or looking at unemployment and how the money has been siphoned away, you know, how, you know, things like even NAFTA, North American so-called free trade agreement, how even that has shipped a lot of jobs overseas or to, you know, to Mexico, where they're paying, you know, poor women and poor men, you know, basically 30 cents a day, you know, a dollar a day, maybe $3 a day to work, you know, for 12 hours, and so they can, you know, bank all this money, but at the same time, you know, shipping jobs away from the U.S. And so these discussions, in order to get people politically, you know, mobilized and engaged, and, you know, towards really, you know, creating like independent voting blocks that support candidates, and even maybe even creating alternative, alternative political parties and so forth, and even mobilizing the politics in your community, because everything, your political expression should not start and end at the ballot box. Your political expression starts with mobilizing and doing work within your communities. Creating organizations, engaging your community, one block, one family, one neighborhood at a time. And just having that metastasize in a positive way throughout your communities. And at the same time, if we have multiple communities doing that, I mean, we can see that movement start to grow, you know, towards real positive progressive work that is antithetical to the regressive work of the Tea Party, those white nationalists. You know, so that those are some of the things that we should think about. If you have ideas, you know, even show ideas where you guys, you know, want to have some kind of show or some kind of online forum with Peter and myself, you know, it's really important that you reach out to us, email us, you know, message us, so that we can start to build with you, because we're serious about this. We're activists, you know, playing the role of radio show hosts. We're not radio show hosts acting as activists. I mean, that's what we are. That's what we live. That's our life. We're engaged in our own respective communities because we believe in it. And matter of fact, we don't make any money from this. Matter of fact, we pay a certain amount of monthly fee to host this radio show. You know, get no advertising dollars for it. We do it because we hope that people will listen like yourselves and will pass the word along, and that because knowledge is power, that power can invigorate people towards action. And ideas, and we need the ideas. We need more people's ideas from community to community to really build some kind of movements. I mean, you know, some of your ideas may have to do with things around prison reform. You know, starting, you know, prison reform or prison reentry programs for juvenile offenders or adult male offenders in your community. There may be a prison or a detention center near your community. That's positive work. That's all leading towards something. That's all leading towards liberating, emancipating people from the bowels of this prison industrial system. It might be around engaging people around healthcare and starting to push for the impetus, you know, to really putting some real hard, rough pressure on your local government, you know, around better health care for individuals. I mean, these are things that we really need to start looking at. I mean, because, you know, you look at, I mean, it's now over 850 military bases throughout the world. You know, there's 238 U.S. military bases in Germany alone. I mean, 268 military bases in Germany alone. There's U.S. military bases in places like Diego Garcia, where they moved the indigenous people off of Diego Garcia to Mauritania, where they're now living in slums, just so they could have a U.S. military base that they leased from Britain. And so, you know, real quickly, I just want to play this, and then we're going to come back with the final 4 minutes of the show and close out. But I just want to play this because Peter spent so much time on the banker, the banksters and Wall Street. I think it would be apropos to kind of highlight what Peter was talking about with this, and then we'll come back, we'll close the show out, and we'll look for it. But that's the forecast for 2011. It's going to be continued struggle, but with that struggle, there has to be resistance in every shape, form, or fashion, which is civil engagement, being civically engaged. That's some of the greatest resistance that we can put together as a community to really make a more humane society. And so here's Glenn Ford with the bankers and the trillions of dollars that we spoke of before.
There will be no economic recovery for the masses of people in the United States. A real recovery with decent jobs at decent wages under secure terms of employment is now impossible, absent a social upheaval such as the United States has never experienced. The reason is structural and in some ways simple. Wall Street has effectively captured the apparatus of government and is methodically stripping the country of both its assets and the nation's ability to pull out of the debt spiral. When the history of the era is written, Barack Obama's term in office will be remembered as the period when Wall Street achieved its definitive conquest of the American state, thus depriving the society of the means to avoid economic and social disaster. Two men helped give us stark evidence of the theft of the American state as it was occurring. Neil Barofsky was the former prosecutor charged with overseeing the $700 billion TARP bank bailout program. But back in the summer of 2008, just 6 months into Barack Obama's presidency, Barofsky reported that the federal government had already funneled about $14 trillion to bail out financial institutions. That's 20 times as big as the TARP bailout, about the size of the annual real economy of the United States. The Obama administration and the Federal Reserve, acting on their own, were giving the banks 20 times as large a bailout as the Congress had voted for. Then, a year later, in July of 2009, Neil Barofsky dropped another bomb. The total federal bailout of the financial class could be $23.7 trillion. About 34 times the TARP bailout, and approaching twice the gross domestic product of the United States. But it gets worse. This fall, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the other key person in providing evidence of Wall Street's seizure of the American state, forced the Federal Reserve to submit to a one-time snapshot audit. It showed that the Fed had provided American and foreign banks with $12.3 trillion in taxpayer money. That's about $6 trillion more from the Federal Reserve than Barofsky had discovered a year before, bringing the total to about $30 trillion. That mind-boggling figure is about half the size of the entire economy of the planet Earth. But the theft is even bigger than that. The Federal Reserve routinely lends banks money at virtually no interest, which the banks then use to buy U.S. Treasury bonds for which the banks are paid interest. This is a daily taxpayer subsidy to Wall Street that also amounts to trillions of dollars. The banksters bet some of this money in their derivatives casinos, which are valued at $600 to $1,000 trillion, many times more than the real economy of the planet. And they spend a portion of their stolen loot to buy politicians to help them steal more money from the government. But they will not invest in productive enterprises that provide decent jobs, and they will not allow the government to invest in jobs, because that would reduce the amount of money the banks can steal. And that is why there will be no economic recovery worthy of the name under the current structure of power in the United States. So, what do you prefer, poverty or an uprising? Those are the only choices. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And that uprising is exactly what we speak of, and we don't know what shape or form it should take, but it should consist of citizens, residents, within this country, coming together, mobilizing through political engagement and then through political action. That's the only way. This government doesn't know how to react, to do things altruistically most of the time. And so until there's some kind of demand on the behalf of citizens in terms of demanding justice, demanding livable wages, demanding affordable housing, not requesting, but demanding, getting in the streets, protesting, marching, being heard, being seen consistently. You know what I'm saying? These are the kind of things that need to be done to clearly. Here's the biggest thing: they have to be consistent. We have to be consistent about those things. We have to be consistent. It can't be just one here and one there. One corporate-backed march like the 10-10 march on Washington. That thing, that corporate backed thing that just, it was one day and then that was it. It has to be consistent. I would rather have, 5,000 of those, with, 30 people each time than just one big one once every such and such years. Because that thing didn't amount to anything. It didn't amount to one damn thing. You know that, Peter. It didn't amount to anything. So,
right.
Peter and I are here as humble servants of the people, because we're with the people, we are the people. Whatever we can do, to help out, to bring attention to issues in your community, even coming out there, to your community, free of charge, just coming out there on our own volition, and helping, put together some kind of community forum. I mean, we're all for it. We're all for it. Like I said, we're not in it for paychecks. We're in it because we want to see humanity brought to individuals, and that's the most positive thing that I can say towards, closing out this year and bringing towards 2011. It's going to be tough, but, working with people that are willing to fight for justice, equality, and peace, P-E-A-C-E, that's the I can't think of a better way to ring in the year 2011, with that kind of motivation. And Peter, I'll let you have the last minute.
Thanks, Solomon. Glenn Ford said it all. Just want to highlight, though, for our listeners, some things to think about. Structural problem. So it demands structural thinking and structural solutions. This isn't about a few greedy bankers. It's not about a couple of guys who got a little overzealous in their business. No, it's structural. And Glenn Ford said, this is Obama and these other officials, quote, acting on their own. And there's this continuous pipeline from the Fed to the banks. Is that democracy? Absolutely not. We don't have a democracy, and we need to fight for it. We need to have an uprising and take it. So with that said, that's what we need to work for in 2011 and beyond. So to Solomon, all of our listeners, peace and unrest, and let us work towards peace and justice in this country and everywhere.
Right on, right on. I couldn't agree more, and so we'll close out. We're brought down to the last few seconds of the program, and remember, it's Your World News 2010 at Gmail. That's Your World News 2010 at gmail.com. Email us ideas, comments, and let's move forward. You know, we've got the platform up. You know, we've got blogs up. But this is what this radio is for. It's for the people. It's for liberation-oriented people. I can't say for all people. We're not for conservatives. We're not for Tea Partiers. But we're for people that are fighting for justice. And so,
right.
With that being said, peace and unrest and struggle, a luta continua.